myself. Yeah, country love and a mercy more than life. America, America, make God thy gold refine. So hey, there's a new American way. No one's serving those deserving, but there's less tax to pay.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Laura Miller.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. U.S. consumer confidence is down again for September, the second straight monthly decline. Consumers are less optimistic about the economy as companies remain slow to hire and oil prices soar above the $50 a barrel mark. Jobs are being added at a slower pace than in the first 6 months of this year. This lagging consumer confidence is happening right alongside the federal government's reporting that incomes are rising and the unemployment rate declined last month. Economists had expected consumer confidence to increase in September.
A Democratic congresswoman from Colorado was calling for a congressional investigation into claims that soldiers returning from Iraq have been threatened with another tour unless they re-enlist. U.S. Representative Diane DeGette says she has received calls from soldiers with the 3rd Brigade Combat Team at Fort Carson, telling DeGette that if they did not re-enlist, they face potential reassignment to units expected to be deployed to Iraq or South Korea. Those who did re-enlist would remain with their brigade. Fort Carson representatives deny the accusation, saying that they are exceeding reenlistment targets.
Union card check organizing could be checkmated by a Bush-dominated labor relations board. In two cases involving the United Auto Workers, anti-union groups are challenging the card checks. Those are agreements by employers and the unions to recognize the union if a majority of workers sign union cards. In LRB, elections are won about half the time by unions. They nearly always win in card checks. Stuart Acuff, the UAW's organizing director, says the right to organize depends totally on who wins the presidential election. Kerry's labor board is far less likely to rule out card checks as organizing tools. National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, an anti-union group, is behind this challenge to card check organizing. The specific issue is whether card check union recognition is subject to an immediate decertification vote instead of the one-year waiting period normally applied to newly organized workplaces. But the impact against card checks could go well beyond that narrow point.
The United Kingdom's Disability Rights Commission is being sued for discrimination by a deaf employee. The Times of London reports that David Sindall alleges that because of his disability, he was demoted from the job he had held for 4 years. He claims the demotion damages his reputation and harms his future career prospects. The charge is a slap in the face for the commission, which is in the middle of preparing for the final phase of the UK's Disability Discrimination Act that will go into effect on Friday. The commission refuses to comment on the charges before the case goes to tribunal.
Here's today's Dow Bob report. Teenage workers, especially in the restaurant industry, face growing sexual harassment and discrimination on the job. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission says roughly 40 sexual harassment or discrimination suits have been filed or settled since 2002. Lawsuits in previous years were only a handful. The EEOC says more awareness is needed to cope with what appears to be a growing problem. Lots of managers and businesses that attract young workers just don't have the training to recognize and stop sexual harassment and discrimination. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
No, not the yacht.
Darling, wake up. You're having a nightmare.
Oh, it was terrible. Oh. I dreamed we lost our billions, and we were middle class.
There, there.
We were both working, and we could barely pay our bills. The children had to go to public schools. Oh. We had something called an HMO.
Oh, you poor thing.
It seems so real. We couldn't even afford my Botox.
Oh, sweetheart, go back to sleep. I'll write another campaign check tomorrow.
President George W. Bush, keeping alive the American dream for some of us.
Easily paid for by billionairesforbush.com.
Whoa, what's this? A maverick sitting smack dab in the economic mainstream, damming up the conventional wisdom. Paul Samuelson is the Nobel Prize-winning economist whose basic textbook has defined economic orthodoxy for decades. Now, at 89, the old professor is daring to defy the orthodoxy on a crucial matter of current economic policy, the offshoring of America's middle-class jobs. The standard line from economists, CEOs, politicians, and pundits is that, yes, America has been losing our good manufacturing jobs and now also our high-tech jobs. But not to worry, they shrug, claiming that while some people end up losers, others become big winners. And in the long run, our economy always, always comes out ahead. Thus, say the economists, taking a self-satisfied puff on their pipes, the free trade rush to offshoring is nothing but a benefit, and no one should criticize it, much less try to stop it. Samuelson, however, flatly dismisses such Pollyannish assertions as polemical untruth. More to the point, he says it is dead wrong to pretend that free trade and offshoring always work to the advantage of the U.S. economy. Noting that nearly all big corporations are in hot global pursuit of low-cost workers, Samuelson bluntly says, if you don't believe that changes average wages in America, then you believe in the tooth fairy. Indeed, average wages in our country have not even kept up with inflation in the last few years. This esteemed economist also whacks another favorite myth of the powers that be, namely that offshoring helps working families by putting cheaper goods from China on our shelves. But Samuelson points out, being able to purchase groceries 20% cheaper at Walmart does not necessarily make up for the wage losses. This is Jim Hightower saying, at last, here's an economist confirming what ordinary folks have long known from experience.
Your dog eats your new sofa. Pet satisfaction rating 3%. Your hairdresser doesn't know burnt auburn from burnt toast. Hair color satisfaction rating 5%. After years of marriage, your husband still leaves the seat up. Spouse satisfaction rating minus 2%. Your car insurance company saves you hundreds of dollars and handles your claim quickly and fairly. Car insurance satisfaction rating 97%. Oh, you must have Geico.
Geico's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? Geico. 1-800-947-AUTO.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How are you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
But who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back. Guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's. Know who's really gelling? The King of Queens. Monday through Friday. Check your local listings.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, we did it! We did it! I have to say, I'm so impressed. Congratulations to all of you who called the Ohio Secretary of State's office yesterday. There's a little face saving going on, but they're recanting. They're pulling back from their position of saying, you know, if you register to vote using the way that the Federal Election Commission suggested on the FEC.gov website, that we're going to ignore you. And one little bit of information that I didn't have yesterday about why the Republican Secretary of State might be so interested in refusing to accept new voter registrations is that ACT, Americans Coming Together, the activist group, as it were, ACT and MoveOn.org, I guess, are the two big ones. And news releases, stories, whatever here. Republicans in Ohio are scared with good reason. ACT's Get Out the Vote effort is working. In Ohio, we're out-registering Republicans by 10 to 1. And so the Republicans fought back. Secretary of State said, well, if these registration forms come in on anything other than 80-pound stock, anything other than 80-pound paper, which is pretty stiff, pretty heavy paper, we're not going to accept them. So yesterday, we talked about this on the air for several hours. People were calling from all over the United States to the Ohio Secretary of State, J. Kenneth Blackwell. And today, in this morning's newspaper, in the Columbus, Ohio newspaper, the Columbus Dispatch, article by Catherine Kaninsky, she notes, under fire from voting rights advocates, Ohio Secretary of State J. Kenneth Blackwell retreated yesterday from a directive that critics said would slow voter registration efforts and even block some people from casting a ballot on November 2nd. At issue is a reminder Blackwell issued this month to county boards of election that voter registration forms must be printed on, quote, white uncoated paper of not less than 80-pound text weight, end quote, which is basically, as she notes in this article, Catherine notes in this article, a heavy card-like stock. So they're going to go ahead and process these things. Now, they're a little face-saving thing. He says that the reason it's got to be on cardstock is so it won't be mangled going through the mail. Like, you know, you just can't trust that post. This is now the official Republican position. You can't trust the post office. Well, you know, blame it on unionized people. That's always the Republican shtick. But in any case, what they're going to do is they're going to go ahead and process the registration forms, and at the same time, on 80-pound stock, they're going to mail out a re-registration form to people so that they can re-register at their own pace. Turns out 90,000 people have registered to vote. And this rather significant, particularly given that the deadline for voter registration is Monday of next week. And had the Republican Secretary of State J. Kenneth Blackwell had his way, the majority of these people, 10-1 Democrats registering, would not have been allowed to vote on November 2nd in the state of Ohio. So you done good. Thank you for calling the Secretary of State of Ohio and doing so politely and excellent. Good job. Congratulations. Just interesting news here in the... by the way, welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live all across the nation on radio stations from California to North Carolina, and beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, with archives at whiterosesociety.org, and also on the tomhartman.com website, where you can also drop into our chat room. Folks starting to show up in there. Detective Brodka noting the CEO of Diebold is in Ohio. Yeah, or Diebold, yes. Good old Wally, the guy who said he was going to do everything he could to deliver Ohio to President Bush, or Resident Bush. Anyhow, a little bit of interesting news here on the stem cell front. This another, you know, this is the kind of thing, you know, the Republicans are so good at creating wedge issues. During the Bush 1 election, when they started going down in flames because of the economy and other stupid decisions, anti-environmental decisions that the Bush administration had been making in the Bush 1 administration, they suddenly pulled out of their hat, that's the flag burning. This is going to be the end of civilization if we allow people to burn the flag. And they proposed a constitutional amendment to ban flag burning. That became the wedge issue du jour. Didn't quite work, but close. Now, of course, you've got the cons sending out the former Enron lobbyist and now Republican National Committee Chairman Ed Gillespie admitting that in two different states, the Republicans have sent out brochures to Christian Republicans saying that if liberals are elected, they will ban the Bible. Okay, But what's surprising to me, not so surprising, actually, but... And I'm not sure if this is unfortunate or not, but in any case, the Democrats have not done a particularly competent job at creating wedge issues. And I have to say, you know, to their credit, on the one hand, that is, you know, they're sticking with, you know, really important issues, and you know, things like the economy and the fact that we've been lied into this war, and the fact that George Bush is devastating our environment, and that he's gung ho on this pro oil position. By the way, we're going to have a conservative guest on at the bottom of the hour to talk about this, who's going to tell us that we just need more oil. That's all. That's the solution to all of our problems. In any case, the Democrats have not become the enemy so far. And to some extent, they have. You know, I have little use for the Democratic Leadership Council, but that's a whole other rant. But here's the stem cell issue could be a wedge issue that the Democrats could just be shoving down the Republicans' throats. I mean, they could be beaten on this thing. They could be introducing, you know, constitutional amendments, whatever. They could turn it into, well, of course, because they don't control the House and Senate, it's much harder for them to make it into a wedge issue. But in any case, they could be really, really wailing on this thing. Instead, they've been just, you know, treating it like the real issue it is. Well, here now, a little bit of news. This, you know, a science story. Just a general science story. Yesterday's newspaper. This is actually first published in The Independent in the UK. You tend to see these things in either in the science press or in foreign press. The American newspapers, by and large, controlled as they are by people of the Republican inclination, large corporate inclination, tend not to run these stories. But just share very quickly, this is by Charles Arthur, the technology editor of the Independent in the United Kingdom. Biological heart pacemakers made from human embryo cells have been successfully tested in pigs, raising the possibility that tissue transplants could replace electronic pacemakers. You know, Dick Cheney, people say he's been acting like a robot ever since he had the electronic pacemaker implanted, keeping his heart beating at one particular speed continuously, might account for why he's, well, we need not go there. Anyhow, because they would be natural, writes Charles Arthur, the cell implants would need no power source and over time would integrate naturally with the heart. They extracted these from early-stage donated human embryos. That is the stuff that's left over from in vitro fertilization. These are not fetuses. These are, you know, a little mass of cells that's smaller than the dot of a, you know, a pencil, that's smaller than a period at the end of a sentence. The cells were injected into the hearts of pigs, which had had surgery to produce an abnormally slow heart rate. The transplanted human cells acted like a biological version of an electronic pacemaker, generating a new rhythm in the hearts of 11 out of 13 animals. So here you have pacemakers being made from stem cells. And it worked. And I mean, this is just the beginning. Of course, this research, you know, George Bush has by and large banned this research in the United States or limited it so severely that, you know, the functional effect has been that it's been banned. But in the United Kingdom, it's moving ahead. It is moving along. Another interesting story here, this from the Chicago Sun-Times, about slave labor in the United States. You know, I've made the point on this program before that we didn't end slavery in the United States, we merely exported it. That most of the clothes I'm wearing, for example, are made by slaves in other countries. We just don't have to look our slaves in the face the way that Jefferson and Washington did. Our slaves are by proxy, sort of like our wars. You know, we watch the video game part of it on TV. Al Jazeera broadcasts the human carnage. We just see the little tracer bullets. Well, similarly, you go to Walmart or something, you don't see the slaves behind the products that are made, and so many of these products that are made in China and elsewhere. But it turns out that there's also a substantial number of slaves right here in the United States. Most of them are either sex workers or domestic workers. About a third of them are domestic workers, and a lot of them in prostitution and in other areas. And frankly, I mean, this is just looking at real slaves. I mean, people who are either they work under threat of violence. This report is called Hidden Slaves, Forced Labor in the United States, released Thursday by the Human Rights Center at the University of California and a Washington-based nonprofit group called Free the Slaves. And they say that most of the victims of forced labor come from at least 38 countries, but mostly are from China, Mexico, and Vietnam. Well, that's a good point. I would say, though, I agree with Franklin Roosevelt, who in 1936 in his acceptance speech before the Democratic Party, said that a necessitous people are not a free people. And, you know, this is really a critical point. People who are not making it, people who are having to give over their lives to others in huge part, I mean, working 2-3 jobs, and they're still waking up every night in the middle of the night afraid that they're going to lose their health insurance, that they're not going to be able to make their home payments, and so on, are not free people. And that the purpose, well, in fact, here's our quote for the day. This is from billionaire speculator Sir James Goldsmith, now deceased. He said this in 1993, the George Soros of his day, only he was British, made his money speculating in currency. He says, in the great days of the USA, Henry Ford stated that he wanted to pay high wages to his employees so that they could become his customers and buy his cars. Today, we are proud of the fact that we pay low wages. We have forgotten, says Sir James Goldsmith, that the economy is a tool to serve the needs of society and not the reverse. The ultimate purpose of the economy is to create prosperity with stability. This from billionaire speculator Sir James Goldsmith. Our quote for the day here on day 34 prior to regime change. And, you know, this is the point that Jefferson made in many of his anti-slavery screeds, and he was very articulate about it, about the fact that he thought slavery was a destructive force in the United States. He tried to stop it on numerous occasions, introduced legislation to stop it, got fought back, and of course, was a slaveholder himself. I mean, you have to acknowledge that. But the point that we are all corrupted by this. And in my opinion, we are being corrupted. Our society is being corrupted by the conservative economic values that say the purpose of humans, of labor, is to serve the economy, rather than to say the purpose of the economy is to serve we, the people. 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is a small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Visit iowapeace.com for books on justice and peace. The Last Liberal Outlaw is Mike Palasek's new novel. Chuck Gregory with BlueEar.com had this to say. Palasek is at his best when writing about small-town America. It's a place he clearly loves, even as he pokes fun at its quirks and reveals the sickness that lies just below the surface. It's a place he knows, and he shares his knowledge in delightfully original ways, even as he cries out for change. We haven't had a writer like Palasek since Kurt Vonnegut was at his peak. Mike is an Iowa author, former federal prisoner for peace, small-town newspaper reporter, seminarian, and nominee for the U.S. House of Representatives in the Iowa Democratic Party 2000 election. For more information and more about Mike's other novels, visit iowapeace.com. The revolution won't be televised, but you can read about it. The Last Liberal Outlaw, A New American Revolution, is happening in the heartland.
For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Hey, what does this word make you think of? Tchaikovsky.
Isn't it? So what's the word?
No, that is the word.
You lost me.
All right, who's Martha Graham?
She invented the graham cracker. Before her, there was only soda crackers.
Maybe they're not getting enough art. Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Tchaikovsky's music and Martha Graham's dance. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts and the Ad Council.
The last hours of ancient sunlight, the fate of the world, and what we can do before it's too late is Tom Hartman's stunning wake-up call to humanity. Conversations with God author Neil Donald Walsh says this about the book.
Quote it everywhere. Buy 10 books and give them away. Don't let this action go unheard. You may feel like a voice in the wilderness, but it is your voice we're waiting to hear. Yours is the crucial vote. You are the determining factor. We reach critical mass when we reach you, and you choose to reach others with the simple message of this book. Let us act at last in the best interest of all. Then the sun will shine another day, and another still, and life will not merely go on, but achieve its highest expression, its grandest glory, its greatest joy. Can we give this gift to our children? Please say yes.
The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late by Tom Hartman. Available in bookstores everywhere.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Four more years of sweet compassion. Conservatism feels so right. I know I'll be well cared for so long as I am rich and white. Four more years of subtle discourse.
Oh, my. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our music from the Swing States CD, the Swing States Roadshow at Leah Jones Music, LEAJonesMusic.com. Much of our bumper music today coming from that CD, a fine collection of good stuff. Tom Hartman here with you, 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Have you seen the current issue, the September issue of National Geographic? It's as if somebody read Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight and decided to turn it into a National Geographic special. I mean, it's just incredible how they've got the photographs of how, you know, the ice around the North Pole is melting, the carbon dioxide increasing, the world is warming up. The result of this is going to be more intense hurricanes. Gee, what a surprise. Tell the folks in Florida that. Yesterday we had Jeb Bush on TV making fun of the liberal idea that all these hurricanes are the result of global warming. Here it is in National Geographic. National Geographic, yeah, that real political rag. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number if you'd like to call in and be on the program. David in Bellevue, Washington on the line. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm great. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to let you know about a little email that I came across that I think deserves a little bit of play here. It's essentially how to defeat the right wing in 3 minutes.
And oh, yeah. It's the site that's got basically Lakoff stuff on it.
I believe so, yeah.
Oh, no, you're talking about conceptualguerrilla.com.
Conceptualguerrilla.com. You've come across it already?
Oh, we've had him on. The guy, I'm forgetting his name now, he's got a just a beautiful deep southern accent here on the program as a guest.
I missed him.
Yeah, absolutely. No, okay, it's a great site, Conceptual Guerrilla, and it's spelled Guerrilla, G-U-E-R-I-L-L-A.
That's right, yeah. Do you know his, what do you want to call it, the framing concept?
Cheap labor. It's all about cheap labor. Everything is about, yeah, I talk about that all the time on the program.
I must admit, I've only started to listen to you online because that's how I'm able to get you. But it makes a lot of sense, and I think that's one little framing thing that I think would be able to drive home really well, because we're all affected by the cheap labor policies.
Oh yeah, absolutely. This really and truly is. Yeah, you know, I'm really pleased to see, you know, Lou Dobbs, for example, on CNN talking about, you know, cheap labor overseas market. He uses the word cheap labor at least, you know, once a night. That this is not only now the conservative agenda, but it has been the conservative agenda for 7,000 years. I mean, It's basically the agenda of feudalism. It's the agenda of wealth and power, hanging on to wealth and power by keeping by suppressing the middle class and increasing the class of people who are desperate and willing to work for anything, willing to give up their lives, willing to give up their political freedoms, willing to trade in their freedom for security, and economic security is right up at the top of the pile.
Well, my question for you, though, Tom, is do you think that the middle class, the American middle class, say, for example, gets that? Do you think that they get that they are... You know, the Republican conservative, cheap labor conservative policies has been to try to get the middle class over a barrel, just like it has the poverty class over a barrel now.
Yeah, no, they don't. And the reason that they don't is because of 20 years of right-wing spin and a huge right-wing talking machine on the radio and conservative politicians, both Republican and Democrat. I mean, you know, Bill Clinton had a hand in this as well.
NAFTA.
Let's just be honest about all this. This is not just a Republican problem. This is really a conservative problem. And no, I don't think that the middle class has figured it out. I think that a lot of people are starting to wake up to it. But the thing is, our grandparents knew this. My grandfather was, you know, gung-ho for FDR. They understood this stuff. But we've, you know, these people are dead now or dying. You know, they're in their 90s. The people who remember who really have a clear memory of the late 20s and 1930s are pretty much gone. And that was the last time in the United States that anything resembling the middle class really understood that the conservative agenda was out to destroy the middle class and replace it with the working poor class. And of course, consolidate their own hold on power. David, thanks for the call. I appreciate
it.
You raised a great issue, a good point. Well said. 29 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be right back.
This is what Ralph Nader has to say about embryonic stem cell research. That's right, not a word. John Kerry has vowed to lift the Bush administration's stifling restrictions, restrictions that could be cruelly delaying cures and treatments. Why the silence? Maybe Ralph Nader worries you might not like what he has to say, or maybe he just doesn't care. The Committee for Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate or any candidate's committee. Visit cascr.com.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Laura Miller.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. U.S. consumer confidence is down again for September, the second straight monthly decline. Consumers are less optimistic about the economy as companies remain slow to hire and oil prices soar above the $50 a barrel mark. Jobs are being added at a slower pace than in the first 6 months of this year. This lagging consumer confidence is happening right alongside the federal government's reporting that incomes are rising and the unemployment rate declined last month. Economists had expected consumer confidence to increase in September.
A Democratic congresswoman from Colorado is calling for a congressional investigation into claims that soldiers returning from Iraq have been threatened with another tour unless they re-enlist. U.S. Representative Diane DeGette says she has received calls from soldiers with the 3rd Brigade Combat Team at Fort Carson telling DeGette that if they did not re-enlist, they face potential reassignment to units expected to be deployed to Iraq or South Korea. Those who did re-enlist would remain with their brigade. Fort Carson representatives deny the accusation, saying that they are exceeding reenlistment targets.
Union card check organizing could be checkmated by a Bush-dominated labor relations board. In two cases involving the United Auto Workers, anti-union groups are challenging the card checks. Those are agreements by employers and the unions to recognize the union if a majority of workers sign union cards. In LRB, elections are won about half the time by unions. They nearly always win in card checks. Stuart Acuff, the UAW's organizing director, says the right to organize depends totally on who wins the presidential election. Kerry's labor board is far less likely to rule out card checks as organizing tools. National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, an anti-union group, is behind this challenge to card check organizing. The specific issue is whether card check union recognition is subject to an immediate decertification vote instead of the one-year waiting period normally applied to newly organized workplaces. But the impact against card checks could go well beyond that narrow point.
The United Kingdom's Disability Rights Commission is being sued for discrimination by a deaf employee. The Times of London reports that David Sindall alleges that because of his disability, he was demoted from the job he had held for 4 years. He claims the demotion damages his reputation and harms his future career prospects. The charge is a slap in the face for the commission, which is in the middle of preparing for the final phase of the UK's Disability Discrimination Act that will go into effect on Friday. The commission refuses to comment on the charges before the case goes to tribunal.
Here's today's Dow Bob report. Teenage workers, especially in the restaurant industry, face growing sexual harassment and discrimination on the job. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission says roughly 40 sexual harassment or discrimination suits have been filed or settled since 2002. Lawsuits in previous years were only a handful. The EEOC says more awareness is needed to cope with what appears to be a growing problem. Lots of managers and businesses that attract young workers just don't have the training to recognize and stop sexual harassment and discrimination. You've been listening to WIND, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
As I wandered into your town, I was feeling just like a stranger.
And welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And back, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, one of the more well-noted, largely corporate-funded right-wing shill organizations, has provided us with Ben Lieberman to chew on today. Hey, Ben, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for that lovely introduction.
Well, would you like to rewrite it? I'll give you a chance.
No, let's talk about gasoline prices.
Okay, great. Gasoline, yes. In fact, you've got an op-ed here that you wrote in the Chicago Sun-Times. If you really want to reduce gas prices, here's how. Why should we want to reduce gas prices?
Well, it's an important part of the economy. It's an important part of family budgets. High gasoline prices hurt the economy, and they hurt consumers.
Yeah, do you think that as you know buggy whip prices were going up that what about transiting to another economy? I mean, why are you so wed? Other than the fact that the Competitive Enterprise Institute is probably getting money from the oil industry, why are you so wed to the idea that we should build an economy on fossils?
I'm not wed to that. I'm wed to what's best for consumers, and in the marketplace, this is what has won out. You know, I'm research into alternatives has been going on for a long time now. We've had tens of billions of dollars in federal research spent on it. The private sector spends money on it. And so far, we haven't come up with anything better. If we do come up with something better, then by all means, it ought to be introduced and probably will be. But so far, the gasoline or diesel-powered internal combustion engine has won out.
And we are now spiffing people who want to buy vehicles, particularly if they have a small business. You can take a tax deduction of up to $100,000 if the vehicle weighs more than 6,000 pounds, basically a large SUV. But if it weighs less than 6,000 pounds, you can only take a $2,000 to $3,000 tax deduction. This is driving the purchase of SUVs by people who have small businesses, which is a lot of people. Doesn't that seem crazy to you?
Yeah, actually, that is a strange quirk in the tax law. The difference in the weight limit. The smaller vehicles, they can only be depreciated, which means the cost is deductible over several years.
Right.
Whereas there's a one-time expensing for these very large vehicles. Yeah, there's a lot of quirks in the tax code that don't make a lot of sense, and that's one of them.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that. Wouldn't it be, it has been said by many who look at these kinds of issues, that if we simply raised, that if we did away with the exemption of SUVs from COLA standards, and we raised the COLA standards by 3 miles per gallon. This is the average fleet, CAFE standards, excuse me, the average fleet mileage standards that an auto manufacturer must hit, that we could pretty much eliminate our dependence on Middle Eastern oil. It's not like, I mean, here you got Dick Cheney, for example, saying
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
And guess what? We're in Iraq. Doesn't it make national security sense to stop talking about how to get the price of gasoline down and let's increase our gas supplies and instead start talking about conservation?
Well, I think this is happening as we speak. The high prices is encouraging people to look towards more fuel-efficient vehicles. I think the market isn't failing here. And all we do with tough CAFE standards, raising the vehicle mileage standards, that's no magic wand. It just means that vehicles are going to be smaller, less capacity, less safety, and higher prices. So this will be a real cost to consumers. I'd rather choose a car, including possibly a car with lower mileage, than have that choice forced upon me.
Well, now we find that a lot of these SUVs actually are less safe than regular passenger vehicles. They're more likely to roll over, and the rollover accidents are more likely to be lethal.
But no, rollovers, that's true of rollovers, but rollovers are a fairly uncommon form of accident. Overall, generally speaking, studies have shown, and this is National Research Council studies, other studies have shown, that larger vehicles tend to be safer vehicles.
For the people driving them?
No, for also...
Not for the people they hit.
Overall.
Not for the people they hit.
Accidents are single vehicle accidents.
I see. So why don't we just all drive tanks, Ben?
What's that?
Why don't we just all drive tanks? I mean, if you really want safe transportation, why don't we be putting money into things like a national rail system like they have in most other countries in the world?
Well, public transportation has its role, but most people don't want to use it. Again, should people be forced into vehicles they don't want, forced into public transportation they don't want, or should the public have a chance to decide for themselves?
Well, if the consequence of that, you know, I know forced is probably one of your favorite buzzwords, but if people are forced into using public transportation, and the consequence of that is that we don't have to fight a war in the Middle East to secure oil supplies, that we're not creating empire all over the world, that we're not the victims of terrorists, that we're not befouling our air, that we're not you know, creating global warming and creating catastrophes, increasing hurricanes in Florida and whatnot. Isn't that a reasonable trade-off? I mean, don't we as a society sit around and say, you know, we're going to make some rules for ourselves? I mean, you know, isn't that how we live? I mean, isn't that a democracy?
That's silly. I mean, like, we're going to ride public transportation and achieve utopia that way. You're just not being realistic.
So you don't think that a good public transportation system in the United States would reduce gasoline consumption like it has in Europe? You know, the average European, whose standard of living is not all that different from the average American, consumes 1/7 as much oil as the average American.
Well, actually, as we speak, car purchases are increasing faster in Europe than they are in the U.S. So that may not be true for very long.
And those cars get
as well as American.
And those cars get incredibly good mileage. I mean, I lived in Germany for a year. We just bought a stock Volkswagen, stock off the lot, and it was a six passenger station wagon, and the thing got 52 miles to the gallon.
Yeah, well, some of those vehicles are becoming available in the U.S. as well. One of the reasons for that is that diesels are more popular in Western Europe, and they tend to get better gas mileage. In fact, you get almost the increase in gas mileage by switching to a diesel vehicle than you would to a fuel-electric hybrid, which costs more up front. So that is a valid point. Maybe diesel vehicles is something to look into in the years ahead.
But Ben, the question in my mind here, and by the way, our number 1-866-889-8894. If you'd like to talk to Ben Lieberman, he's with Competitive Enterprise Institute, which is CEI.org. Or do you have a website of your own, Ben, that you'd like to plug here?
The website is www.cei.org.
Okay. And is that in this article, in this op-ed piece here that you did for the Chicago Sun-Times, you talk about, you know, supply and demand and all that, and you say, you know, we really ought to be drilling in ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which they would like to rename as the Arctic National Oil Reserve or something like that. And that under the Clean Air Act, we're hobbling refineries. We're making it harder or more expensive to produce gasoline because it has to be produced in ways that that produce cleaner air. And you see this as a bad thing. The restrictions on refineries, in fact, none have been built in quite some time. Some say the oil industry, of course, has not built them because they would like to have a shortage because it helps drive up gas prices. Others say they haven't built them because they just can't handle the regulations, right?
Well, the regulations are a big part of the summertime price increases. That's where the regulations are at their toughest. That's also the time of year when demand is at its highest. That's why we see, in part, the big seasonal jump starting in the late spring as refiners have to make a shift to the summer blends. But right now, the regulations during the off-season, Labor Day really marks the end of the summer driving season. You see a little bit of a less of an effect from regulations. But, yeah, there is a refinery capacity problem in the U.S. That's not the major thing right now. The major thing right now is a rise in the price of oil.
Right. And we need to solve that by just getting more oil.
I think that would be helpful. Now, that's not a panacea. There's not enough oil in the U.S. to dramatically reduce the global price or to end our need for imported oil, but it would help, and I think responsible drilling in the U.S. Could be expanded.
Okay, 1-866-889-8895. I'm just going to let that pass, Ben, because I've already made my statement. I disagree. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number. Jared in Collegeville, Pennsylvania, is on the line. Hey, Jared, welcome to the program. You're live with Ben Lieberman of the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
All right, how you doing, guys?
Great.
Thanks for the show, Tom. I just was hoping to not limit this discussion on fossil fuels to gasoline, because if I'm probably mistaken. Everything that's made out of plastic is often made of oil.
Yeah.
And, you know, every time I go into a store and buy something that's coated in two or three layers of plastic, I just can't help but think that what a racket that is.
Yeah, and you end up throwing it away, and it ends up in landfills. And again, Ben, I'm assuming that you would say, so what? If people want to buy things made out of oil and throw them away, we should still keep oil prices low to do more of that. We don't want any liberal do-gooders coming in and making rules about how we should be recycling things, right?
No, oil prices aren't low right now. They are fairly high. That hasn't had a big effect on plastic prices, but the call is right. Plastic is made out of petroleum and a number of other things besides gasoline and diesel fuel. It has an effect on jet fuel, of course, and the price of an airline ticket. So there is an impact throughout the economy.
Ben, what's wrong with us, with we as a society, simply getting together and saying, you know, our addiction to oil is not all that different from an addiction to heroin. The difference being that heroin is a result of sunlight falling on poppy fields. So we just had the largest heroin crop in the history of the world coming out of Afghanistan this year. It's now become the largest narco-terrorism state in the world under George W. And the difference is that we're addicted to a substance that was made 300 to 400 million years ago, and they're not making any more of it. And wouldn't it be rational for us, as a society, collectively, to go back to the discussion that no president has had since Jimmy Carter was replaced by Ronald Reagan, who, as his first official act of office, took the solar collectors off the top of the White House, off the roof of the White House, go back to that discussion about how do we break this addiction so that we don't need to be charging around the world, playing empire, losing the lives of our sons and daughters in order to ensure the access to the substance to which we're addicted? What's wrong with that? Why are you so focused on getting more and more of this stuff?
Well, I guess you just have this strange hatred for affordable energy. I just don't agree with that. Most people don't agree with that. There's nothing wrong with energy use. It's done a great
Ben, I'm all in favor of affordable energy. We know now, for example, that the cost of solar energy is down to the point where if you put solar panels on top of your house and you live anywhere north of the Mason-Dixon line, you can amortize over a 10-year period. It's not. It's an exploding industry. But it, you know, under Jimmy Carter, when he was actually offering, I mean, here you've got an energy bill that Cheney and Ken Lay put together that offers $18 billion in welfare to the oil industry and the coal industry. And nothing, not one penny to the solar industry.
That's incorrect. There's actually a number of subsidies for the solar energy. I've actually read the energy bill. Apparently you haven't.
No, I haven't, actually. Does it equal $500 million?
Well, it's actually quite a bit of money. The difference is that
a quarter of a billion?
Wind power and solar power, these are technologies that survive only because of subsidies, because they're not economical otherwise.
And how are we going to make them economical? Well, I mean, this is the question.
We want to. If they're inferior technologies, then they we shouldn't force them down people's
throats. So we should just keep sucking on that oil straw until we run out and run into the wall.
Well, as prices of petroleum increase, assuming these increases stay, that will act as an incentive to move towards other things.
I agree with you there. It's just the question is how, you know, what kind of, see, in my opinion, what you're doing is setting us up for a major crash, for a major disaster, because as we pass the Hubbert Peak and oil becomes less and less available, you know, it's more of a wham right against the. Let's go back to the phone calls here. We got a bunch of lines are all lit up, and I don't want to drop these folks. Sean in Portland, Oregon's on. Hey, Sean, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Mr. Hartman. I was calling in. I had a question for you relative to the comment that you made a few minutes ago regarding the frequency of hurricanes and how that correlates into our increased consumption of oil. I was wondering if you could substantiate that comment with some data.
Sure. Pick up the current issue of National Geographic, the September issue of National Geographic. There is one of the finest, most well-researched articles that I've seen in years in there. Or you could pick up my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, or dozens of others. But if you just want something easy, $3, any magazine stand in America, the current issue of National Geographic, you'll find it. 1-866-889-8894. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Rick, go ahead.
Yes, hey, gentlemen. What I wanted to do was ask Mr. Lieberman a question that kind of broadens the discussion here to the discussion of pro-business and why the business community, although not entirely, but primarily supports Republicans when data shows, for instance, in the business section of our Grand Rapids Press about a year ago. It showed that under not only the Clinton administration, but many Democratic administrations, businesses actually do better under a Democratic administration, but they seem to have almost a religious affinity of...
I'm not sure, Rick, if I may interrupt, I'm not sure that Ben's here to promote the Republican Party. Are you, Ben?
No, I'm not here to promote the Republican Party, and I thank you for not asking me questions about the election so far, which is very refreshing.
Yeah, okay.
No, but I mean, even if he isn't, I could just ask the question.
Sure.
And I guess, for instance, even under President Eisenhower, whom I consider the best president of my lifetime, tax rates, for instance, were at the 90% level, and of course Kennedy brought them down to 70. But if you look at the time of the Eisenhower administration, 1953 to 61, that's when the middle class was really thriving, and when
that was the golden age of the American middle class.
We've got to. And I guess my question is, you know, regardless of which party Mr. Lieberman supports, I just wish he or maybe you too, Tom, could address the fact: why do we even bother to argue with the fact that it's better for poor people to be better off and for middle class people to be better off? And even rich people, if they pay a little more taxes, they're still going to be rich.
Yeah, Rick, a good question. We'll have to hold it right there. Ben Lieberman, I'll give you a chance to give an answer to that when we come back from this break, if you'd like to stick around. Ben?
I'm still here.
Okay, great. We got to take a five-minute break here. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 1-866-889-8894. We're talking with Ben Lieberman of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Special delivery.
Who?
Pizza Man.
Hey, you're not the Pizza Man. You're the cable guy again.
Price Patrol.
No, you're not. I can see your van. You're the cable company. I'm not going to let you raise my rates again. I'm calling American Satellite to get a direct TV system.
Presidential candidate.
Are you going to offer me over 125 digital quality channels for as little as $39.99 a month, including my local channels?
Ice Cream Man.
Yeah, like that's going to work. If I call American Satellite right now, I can get a four-room direct TV system, including professional installation free. Can you beat that?
Pizza Man.
You already tried that. Well, that's it. I'm calling to get my direct TV system.
Call 800-505-1546. That's 800-505-1546. For new customers only. Annual programming commitment required. Ask how you can get your first 6 months for only $29.99 a month, a $60 value. Offer ends July 17th. Call now. 800-505-1546.
Thurston, where did you suddenly get that walkie-talkie?
I've had it all along, my dove. You see, the statute of limitations on my creative accounting is up. Time to end this tropical charade and return to our billions.
Oh, do we have to go back? It's so cozy here on the island.
My dear, don't you listen to the coconut radio? It's the best time ever to be a billionaire in America. More than half of the last tax cut went to the wealthiest 5%.
But the voters will never allow that kind of thing.
That's what's so marvelous, lovey. The middle class believes they're going to be billionaires someday.
Well, anything's possible in America.
Oh, your naivete is so charming, my love. The fact is, the gap between them and us is getting wider all the time. W's our boy.
Bush Economics. More than just a three-hour tour. Paid for by BillionairesForBush.com.
Hi, I'm David Orrick. Do you have a dust mask? Well, if you use a bagless vacuum and you're sensitive to dust, a leading consumer magazine products testing magazine warns you should wear a dust mask. But here's a better idea. Try my newest hypoallergenic 8-pound Auric XL risk-free for 30 days. It uses triple-walled disposable filter bags. Try emptying a bagless vacuum and see what happens. Dust gets all over your hands and face and back into the room and on the kitchen counter. And you get to breathe it in? I believe a vacuum should capture the dust, not your lungs. That's why with my Auric XL, the filter bags are self-sealing. What goes in the bag stays in the bag, even when you empty it. So try my hypoallergenic 8-pound Auric XL free for 30 days. Call 1-800-989-4200. 1-800-989-4200. Then if you still want a bagless vacuum, I'll send you a dust mask to wear.
Scientists say the Arctic is warming faster than any other place on Earth. The locals are noticing the change. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Water cooler conversation always includes the weather, but in Alaska these days, the subject gets more attention than usual.
We've been having a summer which is just extraordinary. It has been so hot and so dry, it's been record-breaking.
That's Charles Woolforth, a lifelong resident of Alaska and author of a new book, The Whale and the Supercomputer. Woolforth says the North's changing weather is obvious all year in his hometown of Anchorage. Earlier springs, hotter summers, and milder winters, including a record-setter 2 years ago. But Woolforth says the transition becomes more apparent in the colder parts of the state, and he says Alaska's Native people are most affected.
Going farther north into the Arctic, the changes become much more extreme and pronounced, and the people are much more closely connected with the land, and so they have a very deep perception of what's happening. And their changes include extreme thinning and reduction in sea ice, warming of permafrost so that the frozen ground is less reliable and in some areas is thawed completely.
Woolforth says that thawing even affects the course of rivers and vegetation on the tundra. He says the North's changing climate is disrupting the native Inupiat way of life, which includes subsistence whale hunting on the ice.
The whole complex of very major changes that are all interrelated and interlinked, and it's almost disorienting for people to live in a world where nature is changing so fast.
That's Charles Woolforth, author of The Whale and the Supercomputer. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Well, I've been second-guessed by the best of them.
Bow, bow.
Left for dead by the rest of them.
Bow, bow, bow.
But I'm a good man,
bow.
A strong man,
bow.
Live by a good plan.
Bow.
And welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, we're talking with Ben Lieberman of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. And, Ben, do you have a title with the CEI?
Oh, I'm a director of air quality policy, so I follow the Clean Air Act, and I sort of fell into energy issues because of some of the energy-related regulations under the Clean Air Act.
Okay, great. We've got about 3 minutes here left. I got a couple of callers with questions for you. Let's take one from Chuck in Los Alamos, New Mexico. Chuck, you're live and on the air.
Hey, Tom. You know, I live and work across the street from the premier energy laboratory in America. And I can tell you that without a lot of investment in renewable forms, whether that be fusion or whether that be solar or what have you, we're going to be in serious trouble here real soon. And to me, we're getting to the point where spending incredible amounts of money looking for oil, and we're going to need that oil, as one of your earlier callers pointed out. We're going to need that oil for things like creating pharmaceuticals, for things like creating renewable things like rubber and gaskets and on and on and on. And just the stupidity of burning this stuff is just beyond comprehension. But without really, really, really focusing on alternative energy resources, we're going to be totally screwed here in a few years.
Okay, you're a good point, Chuck. Your thoughts, Ben?
Well, you know, this argument, I can't prove it wrong, but these are the kind of gloom and doom scenarios we've heard since the 1970s, and it hasn't happened yet. The issue about research into alternatives, this is nothing new. This has been going on. It's still going on. Bush and Kerry have their proposals. Both want to increase the funding, carry probably a little bit more, though I don't know the exact numbers. The research will continue, and who knows, maybe 20 years from now, 30 years from now, we'll be driving around in something entirely different than we are driving
around. Kerry is suggesting independence from Middle East sources of oil within 10 years, generating 20% of the nation's energy from renewable sources by 2020. That's part of his official platform. 1-866-889-8894. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Jeff, we've got just, I think, 30, 40 seconds. A quickie for Ben.
Okay, earlier you said we spent tens of billions in research on renewables. As far as I'm aware, most years we spent under $400 million, with the greatest year ever was $1.25 billion.
Okay.
So where did you get that figure of tens of billions?
Okay, Ben?
Oh, I don't know where your figures are from. I'm talking about the cumulative figures since this research was undertaken in the 1970s in response to the...
We got to wrap it up there. Ben, thank you very much for being with us. Ben Lieberman of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Ben, thanks for being with us. Thanks, Jeff, for the call. It's the Tom Hartman program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Do you want to find out what the invasion of Iraq was really about? Read the new illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. Once you've read We the People, you'll understand why conservatives are trying to bankrupt government and how perpetual war is used as a political strategy in the United States. You'll learn how our votes are in danger and what we must do about it. You'll discover why the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 matter today. Populist watchdog and national radio commentator Jim Hightower had this to say about We the People.
Not only does this book tell you what's really going on, but it even draws you a picture of it. Read, learn, and act.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. A compelling story of how a government by and for the people has been replaced by corporate domination. Fully illustrated by Neil Cohn, We the People issues a call to action in a most entertaining way. Available.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Laura Miller.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. U.S. consumer confidence is down again for September, the second straight monthly decline. Consumers are less optimistic about the economy as companies remain slow to hire and oil prices soar above the $50 a barrel mark. Jobs are being added at a slower pace than in the first 6 months of this year. This lagging consumer confidence is happening right alongside the federal government's reporting that incomes are rising and the unemployment rate declined last month. Economists had expected consumer confidence to increase in September.
A Democratic congresswoman from Colorado is calling for a congressional investigation into claims that soldiers returning from Iraq have been threatened with another tour unless they re-enlist. U.S. Representative Diane DeGette says she has received calls from soldiers with the 3rd Brigade Combat Team at Fort Carson telling DeGette that if they did not re-enlist, they face potential reassignment to units expected to be deployed to Iraq or South Korea. Those who did re-enlist would remain with their brigade. Fort Carson representatives deny the accusation, saying that they are exceeding reenlistment targets.
Union card check organizing could be checkmated by a Bush-dominated labor relations board. In two cases involving the United Auto Workers, anti-union groups are challenging the card checks. Those are agreements by employers and the unions to recognize the union if a majority of workers sign union cards. In LRB, elections are won about half the time by unions. They nearly always win in card checks. Stuart Acuff, the UAW's organizing director, says the right to organize depends totally on who wins the presidential election. Kerry's labor board is far less likely to rule out card checks as organizing tools. National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, an anti-union group, is behind this challenge to card check organizing. The specific issue is whether card check union recognition is subject to an immediate decertification vote instead of the one-year waiting period normally applied to newly organized workplaces. But the impact against card checks could go well beyond that narrow point.
The United Kingdom's Disability Rights Commission is being sued for discrimination by a deaf employee. The Times of London reports that David Sindall alleges that because of his disability, he was demoted from the job he had held for 4 years. He claims the demotion damages his reputation and harms his future career prospects. The charge is a slap in the face for the commission, which is in the middle of preparing for the final phase of the UK's Disability Discrimination Act that will go into effect on Friday. The commission refuses to comment on the charges before the case goes to tribunal.
Here's today's Dow Bob report. Teenage workers, especially in the restaurant industry, face growing sexual harassment and discrimination on the job. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission says roughly 40 sexual harassment or discrimination suits have been filed or settled since 2002. Lawsuits in previous years were only a handful. The EEOC says more awareness is needed to cope with what appears to be a growing problem. Lots of managers and businesses that attract young workers just don't have the training to recognize and stop sexual harassment and discrimination. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
No! not the yachts.
Darling, wake up. You're having a nightmare.
Oh, it was terrible. Oh. I dreamed we lost our billions, and we were middle class.
There.
We were both working, and we could barely pay our bills. The children had to go to public schools. Oh. We had something called an HMO.
Oh, you poor thing.
It seems so real. We couldn't even afford my Botox.
Oh, sweetheart, go back to sleep. I'll write another campaign check tomorrow.
President George W. Bush, keeping alive the American dream. For some of us.
Easily paid for by BillionairesForBush.com.
I bring you tidings of great joy. At last, our Congress critters have done something tangible to lift people up from the economic doldrums. They've raised wages in America. You're not silly enough to think for a moment that Congress would raise your wages, are you? No, no, Nanette. For the past several years, they've kept the minimum wage in our country stuck at the paltry poverty level of $5.15 an hour. It's their wages that they've just raised. Again. By again, I refer to the fact that this is the sixth pay hike that our lawmakers have bestowed upon themselves in the past 6 years. This time, the members will pocket an extra $4,000 each, raising their gross pay to about $162,000 a year. Of course, congressional leaders don't do such dirty work directly. Instead, these steady increases, now totaling some $25,000 over the 6 years, have come surreptitiously. Each year, an automatic congressional increase is tucked deep inside the mammoth appropriation bill for the Treasury Department, a bill that always passes. So members always get a raise, unless they choose to deny themselves by specifically voting to remove the automatic hike. Thus far, they've shown remarkable restraint in this regard. One bold member who keeps trying to say no to this help-yourself dip into the taxpayer's gravy is Jim Matheson, Democrat of Utah. Again this year, Matheson called for a vote on the $4,000 increase. But by a tally of 235 to 170, his colleagues rejected his procedural motion, thus avoiding even having to cast a direct public vote on their money grab. This is Jim Hightower saying, at a time when the wages of average Americans have fallen in terms of buying power, it's good to know whose side your Congress critter is on. To learn how your member of Congress voted on Matheson's attempt at honesty, call Taxpayers for Common Sense, 1-800-TAXPAYER.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How are you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
But who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back, guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's. Know who's really gelling? The King of Queens, Monday through Friday. Check your local listings.
Your oldest has just turned driving age. Time to add them to your policy. So you get in your car, drive down to your insurance company. Hunt for a space, double park, get a parking ticket, get in a fight with a meter maid, get thrown in jail, meet a guy named Wally. Wait a minute. This is just a bad dream. You've got Geico. You don't have to drive anywhere. You can do all that car insurance stuff online. Oh, that was a close one.
Geico's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? Geico. Online at geico.com.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you live coast to coast on terrestrial radio stations from California to North Carolina, broadcasting, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org. Gene Shaheen is the former governor of the great state of New Hampshire, where Louise and I lived for a number of years. I was the executive director of the New England Salem Children's Village, which is still there. Started the New Hampshire Group Home Association back in 1978. And am on the board, still president of the board of director of the Hunter School, another fine organization in the state of New Hampshire, so I have an affection for the state. And Gene, I don't know if you recall, you probably don't, you and I met at a gig at Cree Lanalick's house some months ago for John Kerry. Anyhow, pleased to have you here. Gene Shaheen, one of the top, the national chair for the Kerry Edwards campaign.
great to be with you, and I had forgotten that connection to New Hampshire, so that's great.
Oh, yeah. It preceded your governorship, actually.
That's right.
We were dealing with some fairly conservative, that's a whole other thing.
we don't want to get into that,
probably. Yeah. Anyhow, we have these so-called debates coming up. I think that, what's his name, the guy who's defending the Saudi Arabia against the 9/11 families,
Baker.
James Baker III, the guy who, when he was in Russia, said, "I fixed the Florida election for George W. Bush." He did a pretty good job of setting this thing up, so it's not actually going to be a debate. It's going to be more like dueling simultaneous word bite-based press conferences. Am I off base here, do you think?
No, I think it's unfortunate for the American people, actually, that the debates are not going to be more free-flowing and more spontaneous, because that, I think, is when people get to see who these candidates really are.
Yeah, yeah. It's an opportunity lost, as it were. Common Dreams ran an article a couple of days ago by Patricia Gonzalez and Roberto Rodriguez called "Unanswered Questions for the Candidates." And there's some tough questions here that I'd like to toss out and give you a chance to, because I get calls from people all the time. And by the way, if any of our callers have a question for Gene Shaheen, the national chair of the Kerry Edwards campaign, our number 1-866-889-8894. And we've got about 15 minutes here in this segment. Some tough questions. Number one, for Senator Kerry, why do you seem to have problems answering questions in a straightforward manner, and why did it take you so long to come out against the war in Iraq? How do you respond to, or how do you think he should respond to people asking that kind of a question?
Well, first of all, I think he needs to point out, and has, that most of the challenges that the president faces are not easily answered in 30-second sound bites or bumper strip responses, and that we do need a president who is smart and thoughtful and who understands aspects of the issues that we face, and John Kerry certainly does. And he has been laid out his position on Iraq from the day he voted to give George Bush, or give the president, the authority to use force in Iraq, but pointed out at the time that before he did that, he needed to make sure that the weapons inspectors had a chance to do their job, that we went to the international community and built support for what we were doing, that we need to have clear evidence that there were weapons of mass destruction. And the reality is George Bush did none of those things. He did not have a plan to win the peace. He was not honest with the American people. And John Kerry has pointed out that that's what needed to be done from that day, and today still, we have not heard from George Bush what his plans are to end what's happening in Iraq. What we've heard from him is that he would do it all the same way, everything.
Right.
So stay the course. Stay the course.
Does that mean that he would mislead the American people again and tell us there are weapons of mass destruction when they're not? Does it mean he would go in without a plan to win the peace? Does it mean that he would go in without properly equipping our soldiers with what they need to...
Well, apparently it does, Gene,
safe.
And this is the problem. It's selling. He's got, and he keeps setting up these phony arguments. He says, and this is part of his standard stump speech, and I'm sure he'll figure out a way to work it into these so-called debates. He says, "Faced with the choice of taking the word of a madman or protecting America, I'll choose protecting America every time." Right? Those are not the two choices. It's a lie. It's a phony setup. It's a false argument. It's the worst kind of variation on a straw man argument that I've ever heard, and yet he gets away with it. Why doesn't John Kerry say, "Come on, George, quit lying to us. Those are not the two choices. At the very least, there was a third choice of allow the weapons inspectors to find out if this guy really represents a threat to us."
Well, and I think John Kerry has said that. He said it again last week when he was in New York and talked about what he believes we need to do in order to stabilize the situation in Iraq and allow us to withdraw our troops. And he says, we need to build that international support. We need to really put resources into training Iraqi security forces. We need to begin preparing now for the elections. George Bush has done none of those.
Yeah. You know what, looking at the Iraqi constitution, looking at the people who have been put in there, looking at the fact that it is still a crime, and we are arresting people, actually, at gunpoint, in Iraq for trying to unionize. This is one of the few laws that we've kept from the Saddam era, that we've kicked open their borders, that we've instituted a 15% flat tax, that the economic conservatives have very much had their way in Iraq, and they're trying to create an economic utopia, which has turned into the predictable dystopia. You know, this is a disaster.
Right.
It doesn't make sense that if you want to stop the insurgency, the first thing to do would be to roll back some of these economic rules, to allow the country of Iraq, for example. I mean, by constitution, we've said that they can't have domestic content laws, that they have to throw their borders open to foreign goods and things. And so, you know, they can't have a chance to recover from the damage that Saddam did, the damage that we did, the damage of the embargo, and then the war. Why is nobody addressing the fact that there's economic rape and pillaging going on in Iraq, and that when that stops, then maybe the rest of the world would be involved?
Absolutely. George Bush set this up. It's another one of those wrong choices that he made in Iraq. He fired everybody in the army, so you sent all those people home without a paycheck so that they were no longer working for the country. Then he brought in Halliburton to do all the reconstruction rather than paying the Iraqis to do that so that people would have jobs.
Right, and they built
Kerry
a country.
That's what we need to do.
Yeah, and these people built a country. I mean, they know how to do it. They've built buildings. They've built sky-rises. You know,
right.
Okay.
You know something else,
yes,
that I'm going to be interested to hear Dick Cheney defend next week when he's at the debate with John Edwards, is why 10 years ago, when the question during the Iraq War was whether we should go in and take out Saddam Hussein, Dick Cheney's answer then for the first George Bush was that it wasn't worth it, that we were going to get mired down in Iraq, that we were going to lose too many servicemen and women if we tried to do that, and it was not worth going in then. So I want to know why he suddenly thought it was worth it when George Bush did it this time.
A little flip-flop there, eh, Dick?
A big flip-flop.
Yeah, good one. Let's take a couple of calls. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Scott in Glorieta, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Scott, you're live with Gene Shaheen, the national chair of the Kerry Edwards campaign.
Hey, thanks, Gene. It's great to hear your voice out here. I lived in Boston, Mass. For 17 years. I was very familiar with you out there.
Well, I can hear that little New England accent coming through. It doesn't sound like New Mexico. I was just there a couple of weeks ago, and I didn't hear anybody who talked like that, Scott.
No, I just trotted out on special occasions. It's great to hear you on the air with Tom. I just had a couple of quick points because I'm sure a lot of folks want to talk to you. It's great to see, you know, Kerry finally taking the gloves off. And, you know, every time, almost in real time, when Bush says something that's completely untrue, you guys come back with the facts from his own administration. I wanted to suggest a couple of ways. I'm in the swing state here of New Mexico.
Right.
And I've been talking to a lot of, you know, conservative acquaintances, and I'll tell you one of the ways that I've had, and they're mainly concerned about the deficit and the United States becoming the world's, you know, empire. I was talking to a guy, a self-professed libertarian, and I had my Kerry Edwards button on, and we were at a wedding reception, and he said, "Oh, I'm such a well, that makes it easy not to vote for."
Yeah, you're breaking up there, Scott. But you've made your point, and it's a good question. How do you deal with larger than that? Why isn't John Kerry making more of a big deal about these things, Governor Shaheen?
Well, in terms of conservatives being concerned about what's happening with our monetary policy,
and liberals,
all of us,
yeah,
but particularly for those people who believe George Bush, when he said he was going to come in and continue to do something about the deficit. What he did was to take the biggest surplus in this country's history and turn it into the biggest deficit in our history. And John Kerry has a record of fiscal responsibility from the days when he first joined the Senate and signed on to the Graham-Hollings-Rudman deficit reduction bill and broke with his own party because he believed we need to be responsible. As part of all of what he's proposed in this campaign. He has a plan to pay for everything he thinks we need to do. He has a plan to reduce the deficit in 4 years. And, you know, on the one hand, we have George Bush, who is talking about extending tax cuts for the wealthiest 2% of people in the country, anybody who earns over $200,000. If we do that, it's going to cost $89 billion a year. What John Kerry wants to do instead is to provide health care for people and lower the cost and keep those promises we've made around education for child care, to fund the accountability legislation for schools that George Bush shortchanged $27 billion. So if you take all of what Kerry's proposing for health care and for education, you can pay for that for less than George Bush is going to spend to extend the tax cut for the wealthiest 2%.
Yeah.
So that's the choice we have. Do we want education and health care for the people in this country, or do we want to give another tax break to the wealthiest 2%?
And that's ultimately what it's boiling down to. John in Santa Fe, we've only got about 30 seconds. John, quick comment.
Just would like to have you comment on the why Bush can't be held accountable if he has broken these agreements with Congress about how he's going to use his power.
Good question. Governor Shaheen, very quickly.
Well, I'm not sure exactly. You're talking about the war in Iraq.
Presumably, yeah. He provided a document in writing saying that Saddam was a threat, you know.
Well, you know, I think he's got a Republican House, a Republican Senate, a Republican Congress who has not been willing to buck him on anything.
Yeah.
But we've heard in the last couple of weeks,
Gene, I've got to ask you either.
Senators come out against Bush on what he was doing in Iraq and say,
hang on, just a second.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Waitsfield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Hi, I'm David Orrick. In vacuums, bagless is a dirty word. A leading consumer testing magazine warns, if you're sensitive to dust, avoid bagless vacuums. And if you own one, they advise you to wear a dust mask. I would never put the Orrick name on a bagless vacuum. They're filthy. My hypoallergenic Orrick XL uses triple-walled, disposable filter bags. They hold four times more than the leading brand of bagless vacuums. What goes in the Orrick bag stays in the bag, including bacteria and viruses. Empty a bagless vacuum, and the dust goes right back into the room you've just cleaned. Is this sanitary? Orrick cleans the air as it vacuums the floor. Try my 8-pound Orrick XL risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-989-4200, 1-800-989-4200. It's the clean alternative to bagless vacuum.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about the Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Do the Republicans or the Democrats have a clear vision for America that actually includes democracy, fairness, and justice? Do the Greens or the Progressives? How can we create a shared vision of the kind of future we want for our children? This is Tom Hartman, and I'll be exploring these and many other issues with guests from a wide variety of viewpoints, as well as taking your calls.
The Tom Hartman Show, 12 p.m. till 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Visit iowapeace.com for books on justice and peace. The Last Liberal Outlaw is Mike Palasek's new novel. Chuck Gregory with BlueEar.com had this to say. Palasek is at his best when writing about small-town America. It's a place he clearly loves, even as he pokes fun at its quirks and reveals the sickness that lies just below the surface. It's a place he knows, and he shares his knowledge in delightfully original ways, even as he cries out for change. We haven't had a writer like Palasek since Kurt Vonnegut was at his peak. Mike is an Iowa author, former federal prisoner for peace, small-town newspaper reporter, seminarian, and nominee for the U.S. House of Representatives in the Iowa Democratic Party 2000 election. For more information and more about Mike's other novels, visit iowapeace.com. The revolution won't be televised, but you can read about it. The Last Liberal Outlaw, A New American Revolution, is happening in the heartland.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Well, video joints on every corner, 14 super discount stores, each one bigger than the last, with giant sales blowing out the doors. And I try to be so thrifty, but there's just no use pretending.
And welcome back. 24 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The presidential election to be held this coming November 2nd will be one of extraordinary importance to the future of our nation, writes John Eisenhower, the son of Dwight Eisenhower, former president of the United States, former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO forces or of forces in Europe, helped us collectively, we the Allies, win World War II. He says the outcome will determine whether this, and this, by the way, speaking of New Hampshire, we just had Governor Gene Shaheen on, the outcome will determine whether this country will continue on the same path it has followed for the last 3.5 years or whether it will return to a set of core domestic and foreign policy values, blah-de-blah-de-blah, obviously. And then here's where it gets interesting. As son of a Republican president, Dwight D. Eisenhower, it is automatically expected by many that I am a Republican. For 50 years, through the election of 2000, I was. This is the son of Dwight Eisenhower speaking. With the current administration's decision to invade Iraq unilaterally, however, I changed my voter registration to independent. And barring some utterly unforeseen development, I intend to vote for the Democratic presidential candidate, Senator John Kerry. Why are the sons of former presidents, Ron Reagan, former Republican presidents, iconic Republican presidents, Ron Reagan, John Eisenhower, now not just speaking, you know, like Hegel and McCain and these guys, you know, hey, we got a problem here. It's, we're not quite, George isn't quite telling us the truth. But instead are actually coming out and saying, you know, I'm going to vote for John Kerry this time. Enough of this. Enough of this George Bush nonsense. Here, again, quoting from John Eisenhower in his guest commentary in the Union Leader, the New Hampshire Union Leader, Sunday News. John Eisenhower, son of the president of Dwight Eisenhower, a lifelong Republican, writes, the fact is that today's, quote, Republican, end quote, party is one with which I am totally unfamiliar. To me, the word Republican has always been synonymous with the word responsibility, which has meant limiting our government obligations to those we can afford in human and financial terms. Today's whopping budget deficit of $440 billion does not meet that criterion. He goes on to say responsibility used to be observed in foreign affairs. This is a guy who's just he's laying out traditional Republican, traditional conservative values. You're not going to hear this on the right-wing talk show rants, because those folks, the bimbos and the Hannitys of the world, they are not true conservatives. These guys are flaming radicals. They are fascists. They believe in the merger of state and corporate enterprise, which is Mussolini's definition of the word fascism. And here we have a true Republican, John Eisenhower, the son of Dwight Eisenhower. Responsibility used to be observed in foreign affairs, he writes. That has meant respect for others. America, though recognized as the leader of the community of nations, has always acted as a part of it, not as a maverick separate from that community and at times insulting towards it. Leadership involves setting a direction and building consensus, not viewing other countries as practically devoid of significance. Recent developments indicate that the current Republican Party leadership has confused leadership with hubris and arrogance. The words of John Eisenhower, son of Dwight Eisenhower, President of the United States, former President of the United States. An actual Republican in this day of faux Republicans, of phony Republicans, of Tom DeLay hustler Republicans. What a tragedy. 29 minutes past the hour. For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Laura Miller.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. U.S. consumer confidence is down again for September, the second straight monthly decline. Consumers are less optimistic about the economy as companies remain slow to hire and oil prices soar above the $50 a barrel mark. Jobs are being added at a slower pace than in the first 6 months of this year. This lagging consumer confidence is happening right alongside the federal government's reporting that incomes are rising and the unemployment rate declined last month. Economists had expected consumer confidence to increase in September.
A Democratic congresswoman from Colorado is calling for a congressional investigation into claims that soldiers returning from Iraq have been threatened with another tour unless they re-enlist. U.S. Representative Diane DeGette says she has received calls from soldiers with the 3rd Brigade Combat Team at Fort Carson, telling DeGette that if they did not re-enlist, they face potential reassignment to units expected to be deployed to Iraq or South Korea. Those who did re-enlist would remain with their brigade. Fort Carson representatives deny the accusation, saying that they are exceeding reenlistment targets.
Union card check organizing could be checkmated by a Bush-dominated labor relations board. In two cases involving the United Auto Workers, anti-union groups are challenging the card checks. Those are agreements by employers and the unions to recognize the union if a majority of workers sign union cards. In LRB, elections are won about half the time by unions. They nearly always win in card checks. Stuart Acuff, the UAW's organizing director, says the right to organize depends totally on who wins the presidential election. Kerry's labor board is far less likely to rule out card checks as organizing tools. National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, an anti-union group, is behind this challenge to card check organizing. The specific issue is whether card check union recognition is subject to an immediate decertification vote instead of the one-year waiting period normally applied to newly organized workplaces. But the impact against card checks could go well beyond that narrow point.
The United Kingdom's Disability Rights Commission is being sued for discrimination by a deaf employee. The Times of London Independent reports that David Sindall alleges that because of his disability, he was demoted from the job he had held for 4 years. He claims the demotion damages his reputation and harms his future career prospects. The charge is a slap in the face for the commission, which is in the middle of preparing for the final phase of the UK's Disability Discrimination Act that will go into effect on Friday. The commission refuses to comment on the charges before the case goes to tribunal.
Here's today's Dow Bob report. Teenage workers, especially in the restaurant industry, face growing sexual harassment and discrimination on the job. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission says roughly 40 sexual harassment or discrimination suits have been filed or settled since 2002. Lawsuits in previous years were only a handful. The EEOC says more awareness is needed to cope with what appears to be a growing problem. Lots of managers and businesses that attract young workers just don't have the training to recognize and stop sexual harassment and discrimination. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
The Psycho Cowboy, yippee-yi, whoopee-whoopee-tie, whoopee-whoopee-tie, don't you?
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 7 minutes, excuse me, 27 minutes before the hour. And op-ed piece, I have to share a little more of this with you. This is just extraordinary. This is John Eisenhower. John Eisenhower, who from 1961 to 64 collaborated with his father, Dwight Eisenhower, in writing his memoirs, co-authored Dwight Eisenhower's memoirs, The White House Years is the title of the book. He's the author of a number of other books, 9 of them altogether, mostly on the military. The guy's an expert on how the military works, what the military can do. He actually worked in the White House as a member of the White House staff between October 1958 and the end of the Eisenhower administration, and he served as the American ambassador to Belgium from 69 to 71. So, you know, no slouch, this guy. John Eisenhower, son of President Dwight D. Eisenhower, he makes 5 points here in this op-ed piece that was in this weekend's Manchester Union Leader in New Hampshire. Apparently he lives in New Hampshire now. That are just so spot on. Today, he says, many people are rightly concerned about our precious individual freedoms, our privacy, the basis of our democracy. Of course we must fight terrorism, but have we irresponsibly gone overboard in doing so? I wonder. In 1960, President Eisenhower told the Republican Convention, quote, if we ever put any other value above our liberty and above principle, we shall lose both, end quote. I would appreciate hearing such warnings from the Republican Party of today, says John Eisenhower. Well, I would say, John, ain't going to happen. You're not going to hear those. I've got 4 other points here from Mr. Eisenhower. Let me share those with you in just a few minutes. First, we have Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service is on the line. Hey, Victoria, how's life in Washington, D.C.? What's up?
Life in D.C. is pretty good, particularly since we're going to be getting the Montreal Expos. And Washington is sort of out of all proportion excited about, I mean, it's exciting, but it's very, very excited because it actually means that people have something to talk about other than the debates.
Yeah, which, the so-called debates.
That is our sport.
Yeah, yeah, the so-called debates, I like to, you know.
Right. Yeah. It's going to be for simple declarative statements and sneers. And
dueling press conferences. Else.
Yeah, basically. But, I mean, that really has been the lead story of the whole week in Washington because, of course, everybody's a pundit here. So I have to say that the baseball story knocked that off the front page. But nevertheless, all the focus in Washington is on the debates and the enormous stakes for Senator Kerry.
Has the fact that the son of Dwight Eisenhower, John Eisenhower, U.S. Former ambassador to Belgium, the co-author with Dwight Eisenhower of his memoirs, The White House Years, a lifelong Republican who has voted Republican in every election since he could register to vote, including the year 2000 when he voted for George Bush, just today in the Manchester Union Leader came out in a rather lengthy and rather hard-hitting editorial and said explicitly that as the son of Republican President Dwight Eisenhower, It's automatically expected by many that I'm a Republican. For 50 years through the election in 2000, I was. And then he goes through this and he says, I intend to vote for the Democratic presidential candidate, Senator John Kerry.
Wow.
Is that getting any buzz there in Washington?
None.
Well, hopefully it'll get picked up. Spread the word, Victoria.
It really should get picked up. I mean, it is fascinating. It really is fascinating, and I have to say that nobody's talking about it. But there's so much that people probably should be talking about that they're not now.
Yeah.
We seem to be so narrowly focused at this point in the campaign. Even things like, as we've talked about, you know, perception of the debates and who's going to determine who won. And it's not just the podiums, it's what people are going to say for the next 5 days that's going to determine the outcome.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And
not being talked about except on talk radio.
Yeah. And
then only by you and a couple of others.
Yeah. The message isn't much getting out there. What else is happening in Washington, D.C.? What's the news of the day?
Well, I mean, apart from the baseball, as I said, the other news really is. And also, apart from the dreadful photographs of the British hostage chained and in a cage on Al Jazeera, which is just so beyond horrifying.
But he's not yet dead. Is he not yet dead?
No, he's not yet dead. But it's a dreadful, dreadful, tearful plea. I mean, he's in a cage. It's just awful. It's the new fiscal year, Friday. And so Congress is trying to figure out what it's going to do as far as which bills it's going to get done, which bills it's not going to get done. As far as intelligence goes, they want to get legislation written on the 9/11 Commission report, partly because it's the right thing to do, but partly because they want to go home and be able to campaign and say that they did that. And there have been huge differences between what the House has wanted, what the Senate's wanted. What the Senate's wanted is much more in line with what the 9/11 Commission has wanted. The House has wanted much more hard-hitting stuff in terms of civil liberties issues, which we might lose under the House, the ability to get rid of aliens, things like that. And also one of the major differences, the 9/11 Commission was absolutely unanimous and really strong, because I've just attended just about everything they did, on the importance of making the intelligence budget known to the American people.
Mm-hmm.
But you just don't need to keep this secret.
Yeah.
And the House bill keeps it secret. The Senate bill keeps it open. Now, the House, apparently Republicans in the House, are now saying that they're going to be working very closely with the Senate on the bill. And it looks like they are willing to compromise.
That's new.
Surprising.
That's new, yeah.
It's very new, but that's why it's news. It's completely new.
It must be that Tom DeLay is being so distracted by the fact that he and so many of his members of his staff are being indicted for felonies in Texas
Oh, God, what a story that is, hey?
Yeah, well, I've said it before, I'll say it again. This administration and so many members of the Republican Party, and that's not to say that the Democrats are lily white, but so many members of the Republican Party this time around, this has got to be the most corrupt administration in the history of the United States. Yes, I know Reagan had more people indicted for felonies and convicted of felonies than any president in history. And most historians believe that the Ulysses S. Grant administration with the railroad bribery scandals was the most corrupt in history. I think these guys have it all over Reagan and all over Grant. This is mind-boggling.
We're not going to know on a universal scale in terms of the average American, those who don't follow the news as closely as you are and your listeners, we're not going to know for years.
Yeah, and maybe never, because there's not going to be any investigation because the Republicans control the House and Senate, and they're creating a Politburo. They're creating a Stalinist-type government, a single-party rule.
And of course, the president is closing access to records as fast as he can.
Yes, and
in addition, so
and has been from day one.
You're right.
Yeah. Okay, well, Victoria, thank you for the news. Unless there's anything else on your mind you think is worthy of sharing with our listeners.
No, these are the main things. I mean, the only other things in terms of Congress is, you know, highway bills and farm bills and who's going to be horse trading, not literal horses, but who's going to be horse trading in farm bills over the next several days as they try to figure out what they're going to do with the end of the fiscal year and what compromises, if any, are going to be made, or whether things are going to be postponed and they'll come back and do it later, which is probably the most likely thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and when they come back, forgive my ignorance about the schedule. When do they come back after this?
I'm not sure if they come. I think they come back for a little bit in October, actually.
Yeah, I thought that there was some session before November.
There's a brief session in October, then they all go home, and then it's the lame duck. But they want to get some of this done in October because, in terms of continuances with appropriations, they just don't want things to go on. I mean, you just can't.
Right, and then they're also going to have to deal with the debt ceiling, apparently.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, Victoria Jones from the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria, so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Great to hear from you today. It's 18 minutes before the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program. Back to John Eisenhower. He is so articulate about these issues that, you know, this goes beyond, this really transcends party politics. This goes to the heart of the fact that so much of the Republican Party has been hijacked by radicals, extremists, fascists, in the classic definition of the word. And I know people go, oh my God, he's talking about Hitler. No, Hitler was not a fascist, ultimately. He started out that way. Mussolini was the fascist. Hitler was a dictator. He was a madman. He was a mass murderer. He gave fascism a bad name, unfortunately. See, it's hard to use the word fascism because people think that you're talking about Nazism. And Hitler started out that way, but he didn't end up that way. But Mussolini, when he dissolved Parliament and replaced it with the Parliament of the Corporations, where instead of the people electing the representatives, corporations put their people in. That's what the so-called conservatives of today, and largely the Republican Party, and to some extent many members of the Democratic Party, are just, you know, full tilt boogie. That's the direction we're moving. And of course, what you see with faux news and all the other corporate media and all these multimillionaires, you know, talk show hosts like, you know, Hannity and Limbaugh and all these guys. These folks are proponents of classic Mussolini style fascism, the merger of corporate and state interests so that the state no longer represents the interests of we the people, of you and me. But rather, the state represents the interests of the powerful, and the tool that is used in modern society to consolidate power and wealth is the corporation. And no, I'm not anti-corporate. There are probably fewer than 2,000, and maybe even fewer than 1,000 corporations who are involved in this takeover, this destruction of American democracy. The vast majority of small and medium-sized businesses in America are ethically run by good people who are doing good work, and they are the heart and soul of America. But you've got these empires, these absolute empires that have been built. And we are in the new era of robber barons, but nobody's willing to say it. Nobody's willing to use the words. To call them robber barons and fascists, except me. I mean, maybe there's a few others out there who are quoting now. You know, I've been writing about this for years. Anyhow, John Eisenhower mourning the loss of the Republican Party that he loved, respected, worked for, helped write his father's book about, and voted for all the way up to 2000 when he voted for George W. Bush, and then said, that's it, enough, pulling the plug. Here, let me quote again from John Eisenhower, another point he makes. John Eisenhower writes in the Manchester Union Leader today, today's paper, the Republican Party I used to know. Isn't that tragic? I mean, I'm hearing this now from so many Republicans. The Republican Party I used to know. The Republican Party I used to know placed heavy emphasis on fiscal responsibility, which included balancing the budget whenever the state of the economy allowed it to do so. The Eisenhower administration accomplished that difficult task three times during its 8 years in office. It did not attain that remarkable achievement by cutting taxes for the rich. You will recall when Dwight Eisenhower was president, the top tax rate was 90%. If you earned over $1 million a year, you paid 90% on everything over that million. And everybody said, hey, you know, that's cool. You can live on $1 million a year and 10% of whatever's over that. People could be, and $1 million a year back then, of course, was like, you know, maybe $70, $80 million a year today, maybe even $100 million today. People could do very well on $100 million today. I think we should go back to 90% tax on anything over $100 million. I mean, how much money does a person need? How much of an empire should a family have? At what point does wealth become so great that it represents a threat to a democratic form of government? This is a question that Jefferson kept revisiting over and over and over again. And there was a consensus about this. Dwight Eisenhower supported a 90% income tax. When Jack Kennedy lowered the top marginal tax rate to 70%, the cons say, oh, wow, look at that. Kennedy lowered taxes, lowered income taxes, and the economy boomed. No, he actually raised taxes. He lowered the top rate from 90 to 70%, and at the same time, he closed up a whole bunch of loopholes, and in the process, generated more income tax, more income from taxes. And they say, well, you know, you got to... Anyway, here's John Eisenhower talking about how 3 out of 8 years his father balanced the budget. The Eisenhower administration did not attain that remarkable achievement by cutting taxes for the rich. Republicans disliked taxes, of course, but the party accepted them as a necessary means to keep the nation of keeping the nation's financial structure sound. The Republicans used to understand before they got hijacked by these feudalists that taxes are the price of admission to a civil society. Very simple. And anybody who was running around saying, you know, we shouldn't be paying taxes is a freeloader. And boy, do we have a bunch of freeloaders out there. John Eisenhower, again, the Republicans used to be deeply concerned for the middle class and small business. Today's Republican leadership, while not solely accountable for the loss of American jobs, encourages it with its tax code and heads us in the direction of a society of very rich and very poor. This is from the son of Dwight Eisenhower. And finally, he says, and this is the kicker, John Eisenhower writing in today's Manchester Union Leader, New Hampshire, he says, Senator Kerry, in whom I am willing to place my trust, has demonstrated that he is courageous, sober, competent. Yeah, I'm assuming he's not referring to George getting plastered and falling down and saying that he choked on a pretzel. Anyhow, that he is courageous, sober, competent, and concerned with fighting the dangers associated with a widening socioeconomic gap in this country. I will vote for him, writes John Eisenhower, son of Dwight Eisenhower. I will vote for him enthusiastically. Remarkable. Remarkable. A Republican of conscience and goodwill. We need more of them. 10 minutes before the hour.
Do you want to find out what the invasion of Iraq was really about? Read the new illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. Once you've read We the People, you'll understand why conservatives are trying to bankrupt government and how perpetual war is used as a political strategy in the United States. You'll learn how our votes are in danger and what we must do about it. You'll discover why the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 matter today. Populist watchdog and national radio commentator Jim Hightower had this to say about We the People.
Not only does this book tell you what's really going on, but it even draws you a picture of it. Read, learn, and act.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. A compelling story of how a government by and for the people has been replaced by corporate domination. Fully illustrated by Neil Cohn, We the People issues a call to action in a most entertaining way. Available in bookstores everywhere.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Out of His Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive Magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive.
survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
The following phone call was not recorded on February 30th, 2004.
Thank you for calling about DirecTV. My name is Lynn. How can I help you?
Thank you, sir. Thank goodness you're there. You've got to help me. My cable company is raising their rates again. I don't know what I'm going to do.
It's okay, ma'am. I'm here to help. I'm glad you called.
They're taking away our favorite channels and charging more. It's just wrong.
Ma'am, I get that all the time. Let me help you right away. Would you like to get over 125 channels of your favorite programming for only $39.99?
Will I still be able to get my local channels?
Absolutely. And because you called American Satellite right now, you can get up to a four-room DirecTV system for free and free professional installation for all new customers with an annual programming commitment.
Oh, thank you. My husband, Nick, is going to be so happy.
Call American Satellite at 1-800-505-1542. That's 800-505-1542. Call now and ask how you can get total choice for only $29.99 a month for the first 6 months. A $60 value. 800-505-1542. At $4.99 a month per second and each additional receiver. Offer ends July 17, 2004. Call.
This is a Workers Independent News Service feature story. I'm Sarah Turner. In a sweeping agreement covering more than 8,000 farm workers in a federal visa worker program, the Farm Labor Organizing Committee has ended its five-year boycott of the nation's second-largest pickle company, Mount Olive.
Well, we came to terms with the company and the North Carolina Grower Association last week in an agreement that covers over 8,000 workers on over 1,000 farms in North Carolina.
President of the FLOC, Baldomir Velasquez, says they won the largest union contract in North Carolina's history.
We have a three-step grievance procedure. We eliminated blacklisting. If they complained about something, they were put on a blacklist and then put in the government computer so the worker could never enter the country again on any kind of visa. And we have a seniority system now where workers are able to apply in order of their seniority and reclaim those jobs the next year. And the union will be overseeing this hiring effort in Mexico during the winter months. Mount Olive agreed to put out a 10% wage increase over the next 3 years. So the agreement stretches from Mexico to Ohio.
Unions, churches, and students mounted a massive pressure campaign, including picketing grocery stores. A company spokesperson said Mount Olive is very relieved the boycott is over. Velasquez believes there are two reasons the FLOC was successful.
They were spending more time fighting protests and other things that we did to get their attention than running their business is one reason. And the other reason is, I think, is just spiritual. We prayed fervently, and boom, the pieces just came together.
There's been no time for celebration, with only 7 full-time organizers trying to implement the labor agreement on more than 1,000 farms. The FLOC is now setting its sights on helping undocumented workers at non-Mount Olive farms. With the Workers Independent News Service, I'm Sarah Turner.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Hey, you're a slave. Chant to the system.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 5 minutes before the hour. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, and Alan in Columbus, Ohio on the line. Hey, Alan, what's up?
I have a question for you. If by going into Iraq was to compete with Saudis for oil, it seems like that would have made them mad and they want to retaliate by raising the price of oil. What do you think?
I don't think it's anywhere near that simple.
Okay.
It's just not anywhere near that simple. I can tell you, though, that every time George Bush talks about we're doing this to bring democracy to the Middle East, that from Jordan to Saudi Arabia, our allies, who are not democracies, who are, you know, they're dictatorships. I mean, let's just you say it what it is. The Saudi royal family is a corrupt dictatorship. They say to themselves either, hey, this guy is potentially dangerous, or they say to themselves, well, he's saying what he's got to say in order to, you know, pacify the American people, but he doesn't really believe that. I mean, it's got to be one or the other.
I agree with you. It's much more than just oil, but it's also oil's involved with it too, isn't it?
Oh, it's hugely about oil. I mean, it's hugely about oil. Iraq had 10% of the world's oil reserves, and it was the cheapest oil in the world. It was right there under the sand. Well, Iraqi oil, you don't have to. I mean, oil in the United States, most of the oil in the United States costs $10-$15 a barrel to pump because the wells are sufficiently low now that you've got to suck really hard on the straw. In Iraq, it bubbles out of the ground. It's one of the few places left on Earth that's true of, outside of the control of Russia. And we're certainly not going to go after Russia to get their oil. So, yeah, I oil is huge in this. Alan, thanks for the call. I got to move along here. Frank in Chaminita, New Mexico, I think.
Chaminita.
Hey, yeah. Hey, what's up, Frank?
I'm curious. You have probably many sort of more sources of information than I do. I wonder if you could find out how much of Iraqis' oil is coming into the United States.
Well, the problem is that there's oil is what's called fungible. That is to say, there's like these, you know, giant pools of it, as it were. It's kind of flexible, you know. So if we buy a little less from Iraq, then we simply buy a little more from Saudi Arabia or whatever.
Right.
You know, it becomes part of the world pool. With regard to how many, you know, what tankers are coming out of Saudi Arabia or out of Iraq and coming directly to the United States, and which oil companies are involved, right now that information is classified top secret.
I'm sure it is.
Yeah, and what a surprise, huh? And maybe some of it is even on the oil tanker named Condoleezza Rice. They've had to temporarily rename it, but the old oil tanker Condoleezza Rice. Frank, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. It's time for This Billionaire Moment.
A criminal investigation is underway over Halliburton's $180 million payment to Nigerian officials for a natural gas project back when Dick Cheney was the CEO. Critics call this bribery, but in many countries, bribes are just part of the political culture. Why should Dick's company be punished for being sensitive to local customs? You give money to politicians and they give favors to you. We do it all the time here in the U.S., only we call it a campaign contribution, and no one seems to object. South of the border, it's la mordita, the little bite, and in the Middle East, it's bakshish. No matter what you call it, it's smart business. I'm Xenophobe for This Billionaire Moment.
This Billionaire Moment is brought to you by BillionairesForBush.com.
Here comes the billionaire!
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Laura Miller.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. U.S. consumer confidence is down again for September, the second straight monthly decline. Consumers are less optimistic about the economy as companies remain slow to hire and oil prices soar above the $50 a barrel mark. Jobs are being added at a slower pace than in the first 6 months of this year. This lagging consumer confidence is happening right alongside the federal government's reporting that incomes are rising and the unemployment rate declined last month. Economists had expected consumer confidence to increase in September.
A Democratic congresswoman from Colorado was calling for a congressional investigation into claims that soldiers returning from Iraq have been threatened with another tour unless they re-enlist. U.S. Representative Diane DeGette says she has received calls from soldiers with the 3rd Brigade Combat Team at Fort Carson telling DeGette that if they did not re-enlist, they face potential reassignment to units expected to be deployed to Iraq or South Korea. Those who did re-enlist would remain with their brigade. Fort Fort Carson representatives deny the accusation, saying that they are exceeding reenlistment targets.
Union card check organizing could be checkmated by a Bush-dominated labor relations board. Two cases involving the United Auto Workers, anti-union groups are challenging the card checks. Those are agreements by employers and the unions to recognize the union if a majority of workers sign union cards. In LRB, elections are won about half the time by unions. They nearly always win in card checks. Stuart Acuff, the UAW's organizing director, says the right to organize depends totally on who wins the presidential election. Kerry's labor board is far less likely to rule out card checks as organizing tools. National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, an anti-union group, is behind this challenge to card check organizing. The specific issue is whether card check union recognition is subject to an immediate decertification vote instead of the one-year waiting period normally applied to newly organized workplaces. But the impact against card checks could go well beyond that narrow point.
The United Kingdom's Disability Rights Commission is being discriminated by a deaf employee. The Times of London reports that David Sindall alleges that because of his disability, he was demoted from the job he had held for 4 years. He claims the demotion damages his reputation and harms his future career prospects. The charge is a slap in the face for the commission, which is in the middle of preparing for the final phase of the UK's Disability Discrimination Act that will go into effect on Friday. The commission refuses to comment on the charges before the case goes to tribunal.
Here's today's Dow Bob report. Teenage workers, especially in the restaurant industry, face growing sexual harassment and discrimination on the job. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission says roughly 40 sexual harassment or discrimination suits have been filed or settled since 2002. Lawsuits in previous years were only a handful. The EEOC says more awareness is needed to cope with what appears to be a growing problem. Lots of managers and businesses that attract young workers just don't have the training to recognize and stop sexual harassment and discrimination. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
No, not the yachts.
Darling, wake up. You're having a nightmare.
Oh, it was terrible. Oh. I dreamed we lost our billions, and we were middle class.
There.
We were both working, and we could barely pay our bills. The children had to go to public schools. Oh. We had something called an HMO.
Oh, you poor thing.
It seems so real. We couldn't even afford my Botox.
Oh, sweetheart, go back to sleep. I'll write another campaign check tomorrow.
President George W. Bush, keeping alive the American dream for some of us.
Easily paid for by billionairesforbush.com.
Whoa, what's this? A maverick sitting smack dab in the economic mainstream, damming up the conventional wisdom. Paul Samuelson is the Nobel Prize-winning economist whose basic textbook has defined economic orthodoxy for decades. Now, at 89, the old professor is daring to defy the orthodoxy on a crucial matter of current economic policy, the offshoring of America's middle-class jobs. The standard line from economists, CEOs, politicians, and pundits is that, yes, America has been losing our good manufacturing jobs and now also our high-tech jobs. But not to worry, they shrug, claiming that while some people end up losers, others become big winners, and in the long run, our economy always, always comes out ahead. Thus, say the economists, taking a self-satisfied puff on their pipes, the free trade rush to offshoring is nothing but a benefit, and no one should criticize it, much less try to stop it. Samuelson, however, flatly dismisses such Pollyannish assertions as polemical untruth. More to the point, he says it is dead wrong to pretend that free trade and offshoring always work to the advantage of the U.S. economy. Noting that nearly all big corporations are in hot global pursuit of low-cost workers, Samuelson bluntly says, if you don't believe that changes average wages in America, then you believe in the tooth fairy. Indeed, average wages in our country have not even kept up with inflation in the last few years. This esteemed economist also whacks another favorite myth of the powers that be, namely that offshoring helps working families by putting cheaper goods from China on our shelves. But Samuelson points out, being able to purchase groceries 20% cheaper at Walmart does not necessarily make up for the wage losses. This is Jim Hightower saying, at last, here's an economist confirming what ordinary folks have long known from experience.
Your dog eats your new sofa. Pet satisfaction rating 3%. Your hairdresser doesn't know burnt auburn from burnt toast. Hair color satisfaction rating 5%. After years of marriage, your husband still leaves the seat up. Spouse satisfaction rating minus 2%. Your car insurance company saves you hundreds of dollars and handles your claim quickly and fairly. Car insurance satisfaction rating 97%. Oh, you must have Geico.
Geico's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? Geico. 1-800-947-AUTO.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How are you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
But who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back, guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's. Know who's really gelling? The King of Queens. Monday through Friday. Check your local listings.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. John Turney in the New York Times. Tom Hartman here with you, by the way. TomHartman.com, our website, if you want to drop into our chat room, 1-866-889-8894, our toll-free telephone number if you'd like to call into the program. John Turney has channeled in advance some of the questions and answers to the so-called debates, these dueling sound bites that they're calling debates, that the lawyer for the Saudis who's defending the Saudis against the 9/11 families, he was also the lawyer who set up the thing in Florida, the challenge against there being a recount in Florida on behalf of George W., and took that to the Supreme Court. And James W. Baker III, he's a lobbyist in Washington, D.C. as well. And anyhow, he's done a fine job on behalf of the Republicans of making sure that no debate is going to happen in this debate. But John Turney has channeled some of the questions and answers. Here's a few that I thought worthy of sharing with you. Here, a question. President Bush, you and Mr. Kerry have both been criticized for your conduct during the Vietnam War. Which one of you served his country better? And here's this is according to Turney what George Bush has been rehearsing as his answer. Some have questioned Senator Kerry's decision to take a jaunt halfway around the world to Vietnam, leaving our border with Mexico defended only by my small band of brothers and the Texas National Guard. But I will not stoop to criticizing any man's service. Okay. Another question for President Bush. When Senator Kerry was your daughter's age, he volunteered to go to Vietnam. Do you ever encourage them to volunteer to Iraq? For Iraq? President Bush's answer, we don't need any more problems in Iraq. Thank you. And, of course, for John Kerry, sad but true. Senator Kerry, you have been described by the Bush campaign as the greatest debater since Cicero. Does that give you an edge tonight? Kerry's answer. Well, I can't do a Boston accent, I'm sorry. I can't make a fair judgment since I have only read Cicero in the Latin translation, and you lose so much from the Latin. It would be nice to have an intelligent president for a change, wouldn't it? I mean, you know, somebody who's thoughtful, somebody who really considers the issues, somebody who looks in depth and into things. And say, I think it would be. I think it would be just an absolutely fine thing. But in the meantime, time for our Bush flip-flop of the day. On the 17th of September, 2001, George W. Bush, I want justice, and there's an old poster out west, I recall, that says, wanted dead or alive. Speaking of Osama bin Laden. Well, then a year later, March 13th, 02, he was asked about bin Laden, and you'll notice you haven't heard the words bin Laden come out of George Bush's mouth in a long, long time. 2 years ago, he said, I don't know where he is. You know, I just don't spend much time on him. I truly am not that concerned about him. Bush flip-flop of the day. Making us all dizzy. Let's just look at some of the actual policy decision, policy differences here between Bush and Kerry on, that have to do with with stuff that's going, you know, that affects our lives. This is just the environmental/oil stuff. Bush supports oil drilling in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to cut dependence on foreign oil. He has expanded options for natural gas drilling in the West. He's provided $4 billion in corporate welfare, excuse me, tax incentives for new energy technologies and conservation via the big oil companies. Favors more logging on federal lands. He says this is going to create jobs and prevent fires. He withdrew the U.S. from the Kyoto Protocol to limit greenhouse gas emissions. He favors storing used reactor fuel from commercial plants in Nevada bedrock. By the way, this is something that has always amazed me. How is it that the nuclear industry, I mean, you got a whole industry, you got a bunch of guys sitting around going, you know, let's make some nuclear power plants. We can make some money on this. We can sell electricity. And somebody says, but it produces waste that's going to be toxic for 250,000 years. What are you going to do about that? Well, you know, it would be rather expensive. I mean, you know, a nuclear plant's lifespan is 30, 40, maybe at the most 50 years, and it does produce waste that will be red hot for 250,000 years. Some types of the waste even longer than that, hundreds of millions of years. Obviously, we can't afford, I mean, you know, the small profit you're going to make off selling electricity for 30, 40, 50 years, we can't afford to take care of it, so let's stick it to the taxpayers. Let's figure out a way to get the average taxpayer to pay for disposing our waste. And somehow, we went along with it. And so, truly, truly. So now, when a nuclear power plant produces waste, guess who pays to dispose of it? You and me. And does it come out of our electric bills? I mean, could we say, okay, you know, we really don't want all this waste. We'll use less electricity. We'll start conserving. We'll put in those little fluorescent light bulbs. We'll put on-off switches on things. We'll stop using these transformers that are plugged in all the time that seem to be trickle-consuming about 10% of all of America's electricity. We'll be more energy efficient. It's not going to make any difference. Because the cost of cleaning up that nuclear waste is not part of your electric bill because the electric companies aren't paying for it. It's coming out of your taxes, friends. Coming out of your taxes. Very simple. So, well, that's, you know. So anyhow, here, George Bush, he seeks a clean sky initiative to cut power plant emissions, but to cut them less than the Clinton administration had already defined. These guys are so good at the hustle, you know, the verbal hustle. John Kerry has set a goal of 20% of our energy supplied by renewable sources by 2020. I think that's, frankly, a humble goal. We can do better than that, but still, 20% is a lot. It really is a lot. He would invest $10 billion in automobile fuel efficiency. You know, you want to do that, of course, Kerry would never say this. Nobody running for office would ever say this, but I'll say it, because I lived in a country where gasoline was $5 a gallon, and the average car was getting 45 miles to the gallon, as far as I could tell, every one that I ever drove. Just raise the price of gas to $5 a gallon, like the rest of the world has done. I mean, this is not rocket science. You want Detroit to make more fuel-efficient cars, or Toyota, or whoever? You want people to buy more fuel-efficient cars? You want people to stop driving Hummers? Raise the price of gas to $6 a gallon, $8 a gallon, $10 a gallon, what it more reasonably should be. And you want people to start using public transportation. You want to slow down greenhouse gas emissions. You know, half of the air pollution in the United States is caused by cars, roughly half of our fuel consumption. We could change that. All you have to do is raise the price of it. The same reason, I don't understand why in parts of the country where the desert is the main kind of front yard that you can have, they beg people not to consume water, right? You get alternate days and you get fines. Why not just raise the price of it? I mean, it just makes sense to me. Why not just say, okay, you know, if you want to live in the desert, and that's cool, and but if you're going to pump out, you know, under Palm Springs, for example, I mean, the aquifer there is dropping. This is water that's 10,000 years old, and the water, and it's dropping a few feet every year. So, you know, instead of a few, instead of 3 cents a gallon, or you know, a 1,000 cubic feet or whatever, however they measure it, instead of 3 cents, make it 10 cents. You say, well, but then poor people can't afford to have water. Well, okay, then what you do is you give them, you know, the equivalent of food stamps for water. You have some kind of special program that takes care of that. I mean, but, you know, you want to encourage. Anyhow, I'm starting to sound like a conservative economist here, I know. And anyway, $5 billion in hydrogen research, Kerry wants to put in, and $10 billion in clean coal. He opposes oil drilling in Anwar. He favors clearing brush and timber only around communities to prevent fires. He voted against the Kyoto Protocol but wrote legislation to cut greenhouse gas emissions. I'd love to hear why he voted against the Kyoto Protocol, why John Kerry did. And he favors keeping used nuclear reactor fuel at the commercial plants themselves. I would go beyond that and say not only that, they have to pay for it. Because right now you've got all these lawsuits going on from commercial plants saying, hey, we're storing this stuff, and you're supposed to, you the federal government, you the taxpayer, you're supposed to be paying for the storage of it, so you have to pay us to store it. I would be repealing that law in one, you know, in a New York minute. Pledges tougher enforcement of air pollution laws would lead a Restore America's Water campaign to protect lakes, rivers, and reservoirs. That's a start. It's a start. He's not my ideal candidate, but he's certainly better than this crazed. Well, I have made an agreement with myself. I'm not going to call people names, so we'll leave it at that. He's better than George Bush. 17 minutes past the hour. Let's take some phone calls here. Billy in Santa Cruz, California, on the line. Our number 1-866-889-8894. Hey, Billy, how's life?
I have an agreement with you. And that is that I will be calling names.
Yeah, I've noticed.
One of us has to.
There you go.
and you know, I always need your help because you're such a moderating influence. But I find that I am more angry and disappointed and disgusted in the Bush supporters than I am Bush himself. How do they lie to themselves on such a massive scale? Is it that, you know, I heard one of the lies today, which was we all thought that there were weapons of mass destruction there.
Yeah.
I didn't.
No, and neither did the rest of the world, or they would have voted for it in the Security Council. I mean, this is one of the most conspicuous lies. But the reality is, Billy, that these people have been hearing these lies from mainstream media unchallenged. People
yeah,
go
but,
on
but
Wolf,
you
Wolf
and
Blitzer.
I haven't fallen for them. So again, where's the window of respect for me to have for these people?
Well, the reality, Billy, is most of them are working their butts off. They don't have, you know, I'm in the business where I have to pay attention to the news, or my show is toast. You have enough leisure time that you can pay attention to what's really going on.
Tom, that's not it. It's what they choose to listen to. They're listening to Fox. No. They are choosing to have the lies that they fell for. To continue, you know,
Billy Fox really only Fox on their best month has only a few million viewers. Fox is not the source of the problem.
Well, I'm not saying Fox alone. What I'm trying to suggest is I hear these people talking on talk radio, and they are very well informed on the talking points of the Republicans. They're not uninformed. They've just bought into a stream of obvious lies. As you're pointing out, calling, you know, the Clean Air Act, you know, that's, you know, the basic lie Republicans always tell. You know, by the way, if it's taxes, you know, when you stop lowering taxes, the Republicans always call that raising taxes.
Yeah, I know. Billy, good point. Great to hear from you. Always an excellent point. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dogs, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Who is it?
Special delivery.
Who?
Pizza Man.
Hey, you're not the Pizza Man. You're the cable guy. Again.
Price Patrol.
No, you're not. I can see your van. You're the cable company. I'm not going to let you raise my rates again. I'm calling American Satellite to get a DirecTV system.
Presidential candidate.
Are you going to offer me over 125 digital quality channels for as little as $39.99 a month, including my local channels?
Ice Cream Man.
Yeah, like that's going to work. If I call American Satellite right now, I can get a four-room DirecTV system, including professional installation free. Can you beat that?
Pizza Man.
You already tried that. Well, that's it. I'm calling to get my DirecTV system.
Call 800-505-1546. That's 800-505-1546. For new customers only. Annual programming commitment required. Ask how you can get your first 6 months for only $29.99 a month, a $60 value. Offer ends July 17th. Call now. 800-505-1546.
For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. According to the Work Zone Safety Clearinghouse, work zone-related fatalities dropped substantially last year. In 2003, there were 1,028 work zone deaths nationwide as compared to 2002, when there was 1,186. Texas holds the record for most deaths over the last 2 years with a combined total of 358. Georgia is the most improved, going from 118 fatalities in 2002 and dropping to 24 in 2003.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I don't know about you, but it seems to me that 4 years is a very long time. These last 4 years have moved so slow. At times I thought I'd lost my mind.
No, you haven't. It's George who's lost it. You know, just to wrap up Billy's point, I have to say, I think that it is important that all of us cut the supporters of Bush a little bit of slack. It is so easy in this environment where the media is controlled by huge multinational corporations, where you have people who pretend to be journalists and are in fact entertainers, very, very well-paid entertainers, I may add. You know, these folks working for the big networks on the major media, particularly on television, you know, making millions, very, very well-paid, he says. No, not a trace of jealousy. I'd rather speak the truth than be making the kind of money that some of these guys are making, and that the message that's getting out consistently is not necessarily the message of truth. I mean, we have the situation now where CBS News has decided to pull a story that they were going to run before the election about how the Bush administration relied on forged documents in their run-up to the war in Iraq. Forged documents. And how could the Bush administration rely on forged documents? Well, they've pulled it because they're embarrassed about their own forged documents, which I continue to believe was a setup by the Republicans. By the way, our latest Bush-Cheney 04 bumper sticker, if you've seen any interesting ones, let us know. Here's my most recent favorite. Bush-Cheney 04, the last vote you'll ever have to cast. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. If you'd like to be on the program, Preston in Denver, Colorado on the line. Hey, Preston, what's up?
Hi, Tom. In addition to the misinformation, there's also just a lack of vision oftentimes. You know, we can't imagine of a way we could have approached Iraq other than dropping, 300 tons of depleted uranium on them or something like that.
Well, we could have imagined it because we had been doing it for quite some time. For quite some time, we had Saddam in a box. Now, the reality is, the tragic reality is that as many as 500,000 Iraqi children died as a result of those sanctions. But in terms of security, we had him in a box, and frankly, I think it would have been possible to do things in a way that over time would have worked toward democracy in Iraq. I think what we're doing right now is instead creating such intense nationalism, such a reaction, that the result is not going to be democracy. It's going to be an increase in feudal society. It's going to be civil war.
Yeah,
we're seeing the Balkanization of Iraq, the Afghanistanization of Iraq.
I agree, and I think in a lot of our international relations, a lot of just citizen to citizen exchanges are a lot more fruitful. And regarding the auto culture that we're in, your earlier guest was talking about cheap energy, but he's not considering apparently the cost of our, military adventures in other countries. And, putting aside climate change, the industry is so polluting. I mean, the spills that take place every single day. And the, Jane Holtz Kay wrote a book called Asphalt Nation, about how this whole much of our society is designed to expand profits for that industry.
Yeah.
It makes communities that make us dependent on the automobile. We don't have the option of mass transit. And they're always saying, well, we can't have mass transit. We don't want to raise taxes. But they never talk about raising consumer expenditures. We're spending a fifth of our incomes on keeping up our cars, the oil, the gas, the spark plugs.
Yeah, and well, not to mention the taxes that we're paying to sustain the military, the largest military in the world, to protect our oil supplies. I mean, that's you're absolutely right. It's an issue that I should have brought up in the first hour of our program when we had Ben, what's his name on from, was it Lieberman? Yeah, Ben Lieberman from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, talking about how, well, the problem is the price of gas. We got to get the price of gas down. I mean, like, give me a break. And yes, there is a huge hidden price of gas, and we're paying it in our taxes every day. We're paying it in the quality of our lives. We're paying it in the fact that we are on the receiving end of terrorism. They don't hate us because of our freedoms. They don't hate us because of our lifestyle, even. They hate us because we're over there taking their oil, among other things, and propping up their dictators. Preston, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. 29 minutes past the hour.
Hi, I'm David Orrick. How do you tell if an air purifier is worth what you paid for it? Well, place a balloon over it. If the balloon flies up in the air, like it does with an Oreck air purifier, that's pure fresh air pushing it. But if it falls to the floor, there's virtually no air movement. Try my Oreck air purifier free for 90 days. Call 1-800-989-4200. 1-800-989-4200. Remember, if the balloon doesn't fly, I wouldn't buy.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Laura Miller.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. U.S. consumer confidence is down again for September, the second straight monthly decline. Consumers are less optimistic about the economy as companies remain slow to hire and oil prices soar above the $50 a barrel mark. Jobs are being added at a slower pace than in the first 6 months of this year. This lagging consumer confidence is happening right alongside the federal government's reporting that incomes are rising and the unemployment rate declined last month. Economists had expected consumer confidence to increase in September.
A Democratic congresswoman from Colorado is calling for a congressional investigation into claims that soldiers returning from Iraq have been threatened with another tour unless they re-enlist. U.S. Representative Diane DeGette says she has received calls from soldiers with the 3rd Brigade Combat Team at Fort Carson, telling DeGette that if they did not re-enlist, they face potential reassignment to units expected to be deployed to Iraq or South Korea. Those who did re-enlist would remain with their brigade. Fort Carson representatives deny the accusation, saying that they are exceeding re-enlistment targets.
Union card check organizing could be checkmated by a Bush-dominated labor relations board. In two cases involving the United Auto Workers, anti-union groups are challenging the card checks. Those are agreements by employers and the unions to recognize the union if a majority of workers sign union cards. NLRB elections are won about half the time by unions. They nearly always win in card checks. Stuart Acuff, the UAW's organizing director, says the right to organize depends totally on who wins the presidential election. Kerry's labor board is far less likely to rule out card checks as organizing tools. National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, an anti-union group, is behind this challenge to card check organizing. The specific issue is whether card check union recognition is subject to an immediate decertification vote instead of the one-year waiting period normally applied to newly organized workplaces. But the impact against card checks could go well beyond that narrow point.
The United Kingdom's Disability Rights Commission is being sued for discrimination by a deaf employee. The Times of London reports that David Sindall alleges that because of his disability, he was demoted from the job he had held for 4 years. He claims the demotion damages his reputation and harms his future career prospects. The charge is a slap in the face for the commission, which is in the middle of preparing for the final phase of the UK's Disability Discrimination Act that will go into effect on Friday. The commission refuses to comment on the charges before the case goes to tribunal.
Here's today's Dow Bob report. Teenage workers, especially in the restaurant industry, face growing sexual harassment and discrimination on the job. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission says roughly 40 sexual harassment or discrimination suits have been filed or settled since 2002. Lawsuits in previous years were only a handful. The EEOC says more awareness is needed to cope with what appears to be a growing problem. Lots of managers and businesses that attract young workers just don't have the training to recognize and stop sexual harassment and discrimination. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Some days I think of those turkeys in Texas, the way they'd all gobble when old Bill raised his voice.
And welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour, Tom. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. 1-866. One of those toll-free numbers. 889-8894. Our toll-free number if you'd like to be on the program. And, in fact, let's go to taxi driver number 12 in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, number 12.
I think one of the best bumper stickers I've seen said, Bush Kerry 04.
Bush Kerry 04.
Yep. I really don't think there's that much of a difference between them. And I'll say it again. I think it may sound conspiratorial, but they're, to more of a degree than we are aware, they're on the same side.
Yeah. Well, you know, unfortunately, at some level, I have to agree with you that that both of them represent some of the very real problems that are facing this country. But I have to say there are also huge differences between Bush and Kerry.
Sure. And you could say, I have to say, as a comparison or a literal reference, you know, are we at war with Eurasia or are we at war with Oceania?
Or are we at war with an idea?
Yeah, they're both elitists from Yale who graduated 2 years apart from each other, and that says, I think, as much as their current political affiliation.
Well, except that one of them graduated with honors and actually paid attention, and the other one graduated with C average and was a cheerleader. I mean, come on, there are some differences here.
Yeah,
are some differences.
And they both got favors. They both had strings pulled to get themselves out of Vietnam or get themselves out of Vietnam early.
I believe that John Kerry really and truly did get wounded. I'm not buying that BS from those people. It's largely all been disproven. The guys are just slimy liars. November 2nd, the end of an error. Kane, or however it's pronounced here in our chat room, says as the bumper sticker for the day. How's that one? A bunch of good ones. Anyhow, was that your point there? Number 12.
That's it.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Taxiing, I guess I can't say keep on trucking. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Chris in Santa Fe on the line. Hey, Chris, what's up?
You know, I got an interesting point about the media.
Mm-hmm.
It's like we talk about corporate media, but there's something really weird, and maybe you know the answer to this. I couldn't figure it out. CNN International, that I used to listen to and watch a lot when I would travel to London years ago. You there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Anyway, CNN International would carry things like Al Gore's trip to negotiate with Moscow about trade agreements. There was all kinds of extremely, I thought, basic, fundamental quality journalism. And you get back to the United States, and you cannot get that channel here. I don't care if you got one of those 900-channel satellite dishes.
Yeah.
And it was to the point where... I don't know if you know this, but Ted Turner lives in New Mexico, and I happen to know the guy who designed his house. So I asked, what's the story? Can you just, like, ask Ted? Why can't I get CNN International? And it came back, it's like, well, you know, we have an agreement, and I really can't even tell you what the agreement is, but fundamentally, no, you can't get CNN International here.
Yeah,
it's just very interesting the way that...
It's not on a satellite that beams into North America to begin with. Amy Goodman was doing this tour around the country. You know, she does Democracy Now, the radio show that has become a TV show now as well. And she has this book. She was a guest on our program, in fact. This book. I'm forgetting the title of it right now. Something like something Error of the Leaders or whatever it is. In any case, she was showing a movie, a 30, 40-minute movie, followed by a discussion. And in the movie, the core of the movie, as it were, I mean, the main aha that you get from the movie, is she was showing on a split screen on the left-hand side CNN Domestic, and on the right-hand side, CNN International, both of them reporting on the exact same events on the invasion of Iraq. And the one on the left was showing the video games, right? You see the bullets and the tracers, and you see all this. The one on the right was showing the burned bodies of children. And this was CNN International. Showing the world what actually was happening in Baghdad. I mean, they were showing the video games as well. It was clearly an Amerocentric viewpoint, but it was a balanced Amerocentric viewpoint. Whereas the one on the left, the CNN Domestic, did not present us with the realities, the consequences of what we were doing over there.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's interesting, Tom, when you talk about the real reporters. I mean, Christiana Mompour, I think, basically blew any opportunity she'd ever have to be on domestic CNN by how angry she was and how focused she was on what was happening with the curtailing of reporting from Afghanistan a few years ago.
Yeah.
And you just don't see her on the domestic CNN anymore. Pretty much at all.
Yeah, other than when Aaron Brown has her on as a guest, because he respects her. And she's one of the great journalists of our age. She really and truly
absolutely.
Is. I mean, there are. She's got a fan club. I mean, I can tell you there, and I'm a member of it.
I'm definitely one of them. And it's interesting. I'm amazed Aaron Brown hasn't been thrown off the air.
Yeah. Well, he dances around the edge of it. I think he's on late enough at night that they think they can let him be a little more honest. It's funny, the cons would say he's being a little more liberal. I think he's just more willing to show or discuss both sides of an issue. And he's not at all unabashed about about discussing his opinions. His opening piece is always very thoughtful, very insightful, and generally not particularly polemical. Just thoughtful. I have a lot of respect.
It was interesting to me because it was kind of a baton passing about a year ago. He interviewed Walter Cronkite for two nights. And Walter Cronkite at the very end, it was sort of, you could see there was just an immense amount of respect from Aaron Brown. Of course, Walter Cronkite's like my hero. And Cronkite looked over and said, by the way, I enjoy and respect your program very much.
That's remarkable. Yeah. You know, when I first got into radio back in the 60s, before I started actually in started out in campus radio at Michigan State University in like 67, and then within 6 months got a job at WITL, a real radio station in Lansing. And but before that, even before the campus radio, I used to watch the Walter Cronkite's newscasts, and he would say a line, and I would practice saying it the way he said it. I got so good at my Walter Cronkite imitation, and it was just learning how to do delivery, learning how to do radio, and he was doing television, but I mean he was an old radio guy before television, and he understood how to convey a message using his voice, and then he took that tool and used it to really and truly inform us. I mean, Walter Cronkite was, as you implied, one of the great journalists of our age. Absolutely one of the very, very best.
Yeah, and then to be backed up with a commentary by Eric Severide.
Yeah.
My God.
Yeah, yeah. We have lost the good ones. We've got a few, but they rise high enough. They make enough noise. I mean, even Dan Rather, frankly, I've always thought of as being, Republican light. He goes over and talks to BBC and says, we've got a real problem in the United States. We can't speak out. And then he comes back here and he says, wherever George Bush tells me to go, I'll line up. You know, it's like, what?
I know.
Anyhow, we can critique the press all day long, Chris, but we've got to move along.
I appreciate
the call. Thanks a lot. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. I mean, here's what it boils down to. This is really ultimately what it boils down to with regard to the Bush administration and the so-called war on terror that George Bush is going to try to make the centerpiece of the talking points at this so-called debate that's coming up Thursday night. Number one, and this I'm going to share this with you. In fact, this is actually organized by the American Progress Action Fund. AmericanProgressAction.org is their website. And they just really boil this down tightly. And so, unlike the guys on the right who every day are reciting the talking points and saying that this is their original idea, I'll tell you, these are the talking points that I filtering, sorting through all this stuff, these are worth repeating. So I'm going to share with you somebody else's words, but I think it's just so well said. Number one, the Bush administration failed to protect the country before 9/11. You know, and now me speaking. How is it that we forget whose watch it was on which this happened? Back to the talking point. We now know terrorism was simply not a priority for the administration pre-9/11. And one of the things that we know, by the way, is that Dick Cheney was in charge of the counterterrorism task force along with the energy policy task force. Those were his two big jobs when he became vice president in January of 2001. And the energy task force met repeatedly, I believe it was nine times, with Ken Lay and his buddies carving up Iraq, maps of Iraq on the table. Maps of the Iraqi oil fields, lists of potential suitors, potential purchasers of Iraqi oil. How many times did the Cheney Counterterrorism Task Force meet from the time Dick Cheney came into power along with George Bush until 9/11? How many times? None. Zero. Zip. Nada. None. Administration officials were focused on missile defense, China, and other issues, not al-Qaeda and global terrorism. Even after the president was explicitly warned about impending al-Qaeda attacks in August of 2001. Remember, Condi Rice. As I recall, the memo was titled something like, Bin Laden determined to strike inside the United States. Gee, what a surprise. And what does George do? He goes on the longest presidential vacation in the history of the United States presidency. And then he goes to Florida. No way he's going to be in Washington, D.C., knowing there's a few airplanes heading that way. Oh, Tom, you're starting to sound like a conspiracy nut. Well, consider it. Why, after George Bush got that memo, did he refuse to go to Washington? For a month. For a month! Not only that, the administration did nothing to heighten our awareness or increase our domestic vigilance in stopping the plot. It's about the most manly thing you can do when you're afraid of horses. Number two, the administration failed to finish off al-Qaeda after 9/11. With the world solidly behind America's efforts to lead a coalition against al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Afghanistan, and they were. They were. Even the Arab countries. And everybody was sort of willing to overlook the fact that we had helped create the Taliban, that we had funded the Mujahideen, that we had put up the money for Osama bin Laden, because the Russians had successfully changed the Afghan government. Not Earl just came out of Afghanistan. And who's in charge of Afghanistan? Well, to hear George Bush tell it, he is. Why isn't the Drug Enforcement Administration knocking on his door? Mr. Bush, we understand you've become the largest supplier of heroin to the world. We'd like to discuss that with you. Well, he may say, Ronnie Reagan and all those guys, Ollie North and that bunch, and weren't there stories about them being involved in smuggling cocaine into that ranch in Texas? Air America is what it was called. Radio network. The CIA airline that was smuggling weapons down to Nicaragua and drugs back into the United States, creating, some say, a crack cocaine epidemic in the ghettos of the United States, which certainly was good for the private prison industry. A big boom. Anyhow, with the world solidly behind America's efforts to lead a coalition against al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Afghanistan, President Bush should have sought to finish the job. Instead, remember Tora Bora? Okay, we've got Osama, we've got him pinned down, and at that point, George W. pulls back the American soldiers and says, well, let's hire some locals to go in and do the job. Right. Right. Just the perfect time to outsource the war. That's what he did. Can you imagine if Bill Clinton had done something that stupid? Bin Laden remains free in the region, and American troops are bogged down in Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11. It's like being hit on Pearl Harbor and Franklin Roosevelt declaring war on Brazil. And number three, the administration drove us into a hole in Iraq and allowed global terrorist and nuclear threats to grow. The administration's single-minded obsession with Saddam. Let's tell the truth. George W. Bush's showing that he was stronger than his daddy alleviated one problem, which many would say, in the grand scheme of things was a gnat, a mosquito, but created a nightmare. Terrorists are pouring into Iraq. The insurgency is growing. Al-Qaeda has been free to regroup and multiply, while Iran and North Korea have expanded their nuclear capabilities, all on this guy's watch. Time for regime change.
This is Vivilnik Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug, the phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it. And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people who listen to your program are what they call in the business my target audience, people who are conscious and responsible and try to do the right thing and try to think for themselves. I would encourage anyone to advertise on the Thomas Hartmann Show, absolutely, without question, whether that be on the national level or the local level. And you will absolutely get results. The way you can learn more about our imported organically grown wines from France is by calling us. The phone number is 1-888-ECO-WINE, or you can visit our site at www.ecowine.com.
How can contemporary America possibly compare with 1933 Germany? Find out in Tom Hartman's brand new fully illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America. Through Tom's concise political analysis and Neil Cohn's vibrant illustrations, you'll observe an unsettling, if not shocking, perspective of America. You'll also hear what the founders of this country did to control corporate power. You'll be invited to consider how the American political system can be made more democratic, as well as comprehend the Project for the New American Century's vision for America. Here's what syndicated cartoonist Ted Rawl said after reading We the People.
An ambitious effort to explain everything that's wrong in America, how things got this way, and what should be done about it. We the People is the product of a brilliant and principled thinker.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman, available in bookstores everywhere.
Now, it's time for This Billionaire Moment.
When it came time to bilk California out of billions in energy costs, Kenneth Lay said, "Send me." When George Bush's campaign needed hundreds of thousands of bundled dollars, Kenneth Lay said, "Send me." When Dick Cheney needed help crafting energy policy that was friendlier to corporations, Kenneth Lay said, "Send me." And when someone had to keep small Enron investors calm so the big guys could bail out before the stock collapsed, Kenneth Lay said, "Send me." He pioneered new ways to create profits, and now he has to wear an orange jumpsuit and languish in a cell without room service. We can only hope that there's a squash court at that minimum security prison. I'm Xenophobe for This Billionaire Moment.
This Billionaire Moment is brought to you by BillionairesForBush.com.
Kick up the billionaire!
This is a Workers Independent News Service feature story. I'm Sarah Turner. New Bush administration rules could squeeze low-income tenants out of their homes. George Bush wants to alter the formula used to calculate an average rent price. The Mass Alliance of HUD tenants warn that could leave hundreds of thousands homeless. Section 8 recipients pay 30% of their income in rent, and the federal government picks up the rest to what is deemed a fair market price. Under the new proposal, high-cost rents in big cities like New York would be averaged together with cheaper rents in surrounding suburban areas.
Well, the Bush administration is really trying to undermine the entire Section 8 program and force people out on the streets as a way to save money to pay for the tax cuts to the rich and the war in Iraq.
Michael Caine, National Director of Mass Alliance of HUD Tenants, says the changes will be devastating for a third of the 1.9 million families who depend on Section 8.
They propose a cutback for next year of 250,000 families and 600,000 by 2009. That's in their actual budget proposals. You know, we believe that homeland security should begin with a home. The other thing you hear from HUD is they're going to cut people off of Section 8 so they can go out and buy a house. That's their line, that they want to end dependency and get people into the market and become homeowners. But, you know, poor, elderly, handicapped, and large families, on welfare, who are typically the people who receive Section 8 assistance, are not exactly in a position to go out and buy a house when their housing subsidies end and they're out on the street.
If the changes go through, Section 8 tenants in New York City would have to pay 14% more for a four-bedroom apartment, and residents fear landlords will quit participating in the program. The final publication of the rules will be October 1st. With the Workers Independent News Service, I'm Sarah Turner.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
What kind of fool do you take me for? You stole my heart and now you're back for more.
And welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. The Bush administration disregarded intelligence reports. This in The Guardian. Again, why do we have to keep turning to the British press for the truth about what's happening in the United States of America? Suzanne Goldberg in Washington, a reporter in Washington writing for The Guardian. The headline: Bush ignored warnings on Iraq insurgency threat before invasion. And here's the story. I'll just share a little bit of it with you. It's worth quoting. The Bush administration disregarded intelligence reports 2 months before the invasion of Iraq, which warned that a war could unleash a violent insurgency and rising anti-U.S. sentiment in the Middle East. It emerged yesterday. The warning, delivered in two classified reports to the White House in January of 2003, was prepared by the National Intelligence Council, the same advisory board that warned the Bush administration last month that the violence in Iraq could descend into a civil war. One of the pre-war assessments, Suzanne Goldberg writing in The Guardian, one of the pre-war assessments said it would take years. Now, this is what George Bush was told before he decided to go into Iraq. It would take years of tumult before democracy was established in Iraq and the country could revert to its tradition of authoritarian rule. According to the New York Times, it also warned that the new authorities in Iraq could face a guerrilla war. You know, everybody is saying, and this is all over the news reports, the biggest problem that we have is the Ba'athists, the leftovers, the holdovers, the pro-Saddam forces. They're not pro-Saddam. Saddam's gone. They're not trying to bring him back. They're not running around saying, give us back Saddam. We liked him. We'd like him back. No. Sorry. They're nationalists. They're people who are saying, you know, even if our leader's a bum, he's our bum. This is our nation. Thank you very much. You know, frankly, I got to say, if Mexico invaded the United States to try to depose George Bush, say Mexico said, you know, George Bush, he didn't really win the election. We're going to help throw him out. I would be there defending him. He's my bum. That's how these guys are, you know, no pun intended. That's how these guys are responding. They're saying, this is a nationalist uprising. When are we going to get it? Thanks to Louise for producing our show today, to Ira Gravatt for engineering it, to Brad for our music, to Ben Birch at White Rose Society for the archives, and to Mike Toth for the archives at TomHartman.com, the folks in our chat room, to Jay for our music, to you for showing up. See you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Visit iowapeace.com for books on justice and peace. The Last Liberal Outlaw is Mike Palasek's new novel. Chuck Gregory with BlueEar.com had this to say. Palasek is at his best when writing about small-town America. It's a place he clearly loves, even as he pokes fun at its quirks and reveals the sickness that lies just below the surface. It's a place he knows, and he shares his knowledge in delightfully original ways, even as he cries out for change. We haven't had a writer like Palasek since Kurt Vonnegut was at his peak. Mike is an Iowa author, former federal prisoner for peace, small-town newspaper reporter, seminarian, and nominee for the U.S. House of Representatives in the Iowa Democratic Party 2000 election. For more information and more about Mike's other novels, visit iowapeace.com. The revolution won't be televised, but you can read about it. The Last Liberal Outlaw, A New American Revolution, is happening.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.